State Representative Will Guzzardi, 30 Rock and Pitch Perfect 1 and 2 writer Kay Cannon, and Nico Osteria chef and James Beard nominee Erling Wubauer. And now here's your host, a man who is looking to move the draft down, Justin Kaufman.
That's good. I think it's supposed to be a man who's looking to move down in the draft. But I'll take move the draft down. I'd like to move the draft down to Nashville. Oh, move the draft town is what she said. Yes, she's right. She's absolutely right. I do want to move to draft town. Who wouldn't? That seems like the coolest town going. Everyone keeps talking about Madison, Wisconsin, or maybe in Austin, Texas. No way, man. Draft town. I'm going to sell my condo. See what they've got. If they've got any anything close to the L, close to shopping in draft town. Oh, draft town, where you can kick a ball. That's essentially draft town. Welcome to the download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock here on WGN Radio. Wow, do we have a jam-packed show for you tonight to get pumped up for the weekend. There's so many great events, shows, performances, experiences happening all over the Chicago area. And tonight we're going to talk about some of it. One of the big ones is the NFL draft, as I just mentioned, draft town. Oh, you know what? Draft town's sold out. Such a sellout town. Used to be cool. Now it's just overpriced. Like in the span of a minute, it's become yuppie town. Well, the NFL draft, the Bears, get this, the Bears moved down in the second round. So how about that? Maybe that's why I got confused there. That's interesting. So they swap picks with the Buffalo Bills, and they pick up the Bills' fourth rounder. How about that? So they got it back. Last night was so much fun. We did 3 hours of first-round coverage of the NFL draft. Izzy Adonishe, Jim Kaufman, Doug Plank, everybody talking about booing Leonard Floyd. It's really dumb. But we're not just going to talk about that. We're not doing 3 hours tonight. We're just going to check in. We're checking with Adam Hoge a little bit later. He's at Hallis Hall. Also, Kevin Powell's down at Draft Town, so we'll see if something happens where the Bears do any more moving and shaking, we can get him on the line. We'll also talk some politics tonight. Next week's a big one for the General Assembly to vote on a measure that will change the way that we are taxed. They got to do it by next week. It's a referendum piece. It'd have to be on the ballot in November, but first it's got to make it through the House and Senate. The movement for a fair, progressive tax in Illinois. That plus we'll talk about the new Future Caucus. No, not the rapper Future. Our future. On Monday, the Chicago Improv Festival returns for its 19th year. 19 years of a festival that celebrates Chicago's true art form. Co-founder Jonathan Pitts has been there for the entire run, and he's going to join me tonight to talk about his work and keeping this festival alive. That'll be fun. Full disclosure, I've done the Improv Fest a few years. I actually have Schadenfreude, the sketch comedy group I was in, because it's called the Improv Fest, but there's also sketch comedy, won the Festival Highlight Award in 2001, 2002, 15 years ago. Wow. At the Athenaeum. Got the Festival Award because we spent so much money to bring in bagpipers and a color guard and cheerleaders and a gospel choir. We were young, and we did a huge, huge sort of variety show to celebrate being on the main stage at the Improv Festival, which probably cost about $2,500 out of our pockets. When they get those manners, it's fun. So we did that. Also, the James Beard Awards, the Oscars of the food world, are happening on Monday night as well. We'll continue our series featuring some of Chicago's nominees. Tonight, we'll talk with Erling Wubauer, the chef at Nico Osteria. It's up for Best Chef Great Lakes. How about that, huh? That category's all Chicago. Very excited about that. We'll talk with Erling about being at the helm of that great Italian seafood place up on Rush Street. And then we'll also talk with Steve Dolinsky, Chicago's Hungry Hound. He's going to be here to give his picks on the winners and the omissions of who's not represented at the James Beards. It's a big weekend. It's not just everyone flies in from all over the country Saturday, Sunday morning to be able to come here to celebrate the food world. And so all you have to really do is rent a tux and walk around like you're somebody on Monday night, and you can pretty much eat the world's greatest food, right? That's what we should do. We should do like a we should do like a DIY or like a hack. Like we've hacked the James Beard Awards. We know we're that's what the show should be on Monday night. How to act like you just won a James Beard and go to each party afterwards, put a little medal on, and everybody lets you in, and everyone showers you with adoration. And frankly, you didn't do anything except go to the Genghis and get a tux. So we'll talk with Steve Dolinsky coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. And if you're looking for some comedy to celebrate a great cause, Last for Limbs may be for you. It's an improv and comedy show that tomorrow night it's raising money for the Steps for Faith Foundation, an organization that helps millions of amputees. 30 Rock and Pitch Perfect writer Kay Cannon is emceeing the event, and she'll join us again. She was on our show last year. She'll join us later tonight. I'm excited to talk to Kay, see what she's been up to. Because we talked to her before Pitch Perfect 2 came out. So it'd be good to get her feel for how it went and what she's working on now. And it's Friday, guys. So let's get your judging ears on. It's time for the frying pan. Steve Gadlin, our local entrepreneur, will be here to workshop a new invention. I'm excited. Pete, I know Pete Zimmerman's excited. Always excited for this. 312-981-7200. We're going to do the yay or nay on the frying pan idea. I have a feeling tonight's going to be a winner. I just know it. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago, starring those who know it well. All right, great stuff tonight. Let's start it off as we do every night with Carry Out. This is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Protesters stormed the California Republican Convention in Orange County today to disrupt Donald Trump's speech. Yawn. Been there, done that. Bought the t-shirt. Come on, California. We've moved on to bigger things, like who can go in whose bathroom. Speaking of that, is that really what we're talking about? I mean, what's next? Are we going to start doing genital checks outside the Target bathroom? Like a wand in the airport? Excuse me, sir. Sir, can you please take that penis out of your pants? An employee of the Woodridge Room Place Furniture is being charged with arson for burning down the store. Maybe it was a protest that the new line of ottomans didn't come in gray. Also, an ottoman shouldn't cost $500. Maybe that's what he was protesting? No, he wasn't. He's just an arsonist? Okay, great. A 19-year-old woman was beaten on a CTA train last night, and according to her, two male passengers witnessed the robbery and beating and did nothing. Come on, that's terrible. What is going on, Chicago? Even if you don't want to get involved, huff, you know, or at least pretend like you're stuck in your chair. You wanted to help, but your headphones were stopping you. Doing nothing? I mean, we're humans. What are we, fish? I mean, that seems like something a fish would do. A fish sees a shark eating a dolphin. I'm just going to swim this way. Come on. Let's get it together. Get it together, Chicago. A new study on binge drinking says that our brains are looking to reward our stress, and that's why we drink more. So let me get this straight. Stress causes us to drink, and then drinking causes us to stress, and then stress causes us to drink, and before you know it, we're playing Golden Tee in Wrigleyville. Vicious cycle. Vicious. Microsoft just bought a ton of human DNA. Yep, they're buying up strands of human DNA to experiment with how much data they can store. Really? Either the Office Depot was out of external hard drives or Microsoft is getting all Frankenstein up in this 21st century. Maybe they're making a computer that has green eyes and detached earlobes. In weather, same. It's just about Cinco de Mayo here, Chicago, and I, for one, am not going to accept a 45-degree Cinco de Mayo. I refuse to drink Corona and eat guacamole with my winter jacket on. Okay? Are we cool? In sports, Laramie Tunsil had an allergic reaction to something. Yeah, I wonder what. And he didn't show up for his press conference. Yeah, I bet he had an allergic reaction to Twitter. He eventually showed up and just ignored the questions. And last night at the NFL draft, there were some Chicago Bears fans that were booing when the Bears picked Leonard Floyd, the outside linebacker from Georgia, with the 9th overall pick. So funny. I love it. I love when fans boo. Boo! You picked the best pass rusher in the draft. Boo! I wish you picked someone from Ohio State. Boo! Is that what we're supposed to do? Boo? Boo? Where'd you go, boo?
The Cubs started a three-game set with the Braves today at Wrigley Field. The Cubs won again, but the big highlight had to be the seventh-inning stretch by rapper Warren G. I don't have the clip, but just imagine what Warren G sounds like doing the stretch. Exactly. Chris Bryant didn't play today, but they're saying minor ankle injury. So if I were Coach Madden, I'd just keep him out till September. The White Sox are in Baltimore for game two. They got shellacked last night, but good news, Jose Abreu looks to be heating up. Bad news, John Danks looks to be not. Ugh. And finally, there seems to be a trash fire problem in Lincoln Park and Lakeview. Six different trash fires were set last night. Trash fires, getting us one step closer to living a real-life idiocracy. Congrats, Chicago. You're really doing it. You're really doing it today. Well, that's the carryout for April 29th, 2016. Live a little tonight. Instead of a hamburger, get the double. I mean, it's not going to hurt, right?
More to come tonight on The Download. Adam Hoge, Kevin Powell are out and about. The NFL draft, the Bears are coming up. They got one or two more picks till they get their pick. They traded with Buffalo. We'll check in with Adam. Coming up here, it's The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. That track. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The NFL draft continues. Round two, the big story for the Chicago Bears. They don't stand pat. They actually trade down. They had the eighth pick in the second round. They swapped picks with Buffalo, and they also picked up Buffalo's fourth round pick to win back the pick that they lost yesterday by having to move up to get Georgia's Leonard Floyd. So it's exciting to see because right now on the clock are the Green Bay Packers with the 48th pick. The 49th pick of the draft is the Chicago Bears. So that's coming up next. So we'll have that announcement. What I like about the second round of the draft, Pete, this is where the commissioner steps aside and all the former players for the teams come up and introduce the picks. So like Deuce McAllister just introduced the New Orleans Saints pick.
Nice.
And our guest from last night, Izzy Adonijé, is doing the third round pick for the Bears.
Do we know the second?
We don't. I'm excited.
Let's take a guess. It's
such a great idea.
Let's do it.
I will say Nate Vasher.
Ah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Jonathan Quinn. I think they'll call him back.
Okay. All right. I'll
maybe working there.
Someone's got to keep Draft Town clean. All right. I will say Cap Boso.
Ah.
A tight end.
Bill number 89.
Yeah, something like that. 86, maybe?
86.
Yeah.
All right, Nate Vasher, Cap Boso.
Let's see. The Green Bay Packers have brought out somebody. I don't know. But Roger Goodell is actually introducing this one.
Here, do you want to see? Let's see.
From Virginia Tech, selected in the third round of the 1995 draft by the Packers, wide receiver Antonio Freeman.
The boos. Now that's where you boo, Chicago. That's why the boos are on.
Antonio Freeman.
See, Antonio Freeman.
Yeah.
So who's going to, yeah.
Got to be an 85 Bear, Emory Moorhead.
I'll say Curtis Conway.
What's the other guy, the other receiver, the other disappointing receiver?
Jeff Graham on the other side. Oh, yeah, David Terrell.
Oh, yeah, David Terrell, yeah, from Michigan.
If they brought out a guy like David Terrell, and Roger Goodell's like, ladies from the, remember him? Everybody would be like, get off the stage. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to introduce middle linebacker Barry Minter. Yeah, right. The second round pick. I'm now excited. It looks like we're not going to make it time-wise. But the offensive tackle from Indiana, Jason Spriggs, is a guy that the Bears will be beating up on in the future. He's picked by the Packers. All right, the Bears are on the clock. It's going to take a couple minutes here as they do all this stuff. It's a 5-minute clock. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Are we break or are we going?
Yeah, let's take a break.
We'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll get Martyr involved, and hopefully we'll time this up perfect. It's the download. Stay with us. Wow, take a look at this. The Bears trade again. What's happening here? Pete Zimmerman, fill me in. So the Bears, looks like the Bears were on the clock, and now Seattle's on the clock. So it looks like the Bears have traded their second-round pick to Seattle for what? That's what I need to know. Okay, here's what.
Yeah.
Okay, so what just happened? Adam Hogue joins us from WGN.
The Seahawks pick is at number 56.
Okay.
In the second round. So.
So they've moved down once again.
Hang on one second. Yep. Hang on one second.
This is draft stuff happening in the moment. I love it. Rob Martyr, this is how it's done.
Yeah, you know what? This is what's so fun about, you know, the second and third rounds of the draft, because you don't really know what the Bears are after at this point because they're going down. Normally you see teams move up because they want a particular player.
Right.
This is interesting.
It is
guys,
interesting.
Guys, I have the trade details if you want.
Okay, yeah. Adam Hogue, WGN Radio Sports. He's up at Hallis Hall. Adam, what's going on here?
The Bears are getting the Seahawks number 56 overall pick in the second round.
Okay.
And they are also getting the Seahawks fourth round pick, number 124. So in the last, 30 minutes or so, they've added two more fourth round picks, trading back twice. So the Bears now have three fourth round picks tomorrow.
Okay, so I have to ask, what's the method to the madness here? I mean, are you getting a feel for what they're trying to do? That they recognize that the players they wanted are either gone or will be available later in the draft?
Yeah, well, obviously they're seeing guys come off their draft board that they like, and they usually have these guys kind of in clusters. So, you know, there was a report out there from Ian Rappaport that the Bears actually tried to trade up with the Cowboys to where the Cowboys took Jalen Smith earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That was at number 34, the third pick tonight. And that didn't happen. That didn't materialize, at least according to that report from Ian Rappaport. So after that happens, six guys come off the board, Jalen Smith, Hunter Henry, Miles Jack, Chris Jones, Xavien Howard, and Noah Spence. I mean, the Bears probably wanted one of those guys, and he came off the board at that point, whoever that guy was. And then the Bears decide, okay, well, that cluster's gone. We think we can get our guy later on, and we're going to trade with the Bills. And then maybe that scenario played out one more time as they watch another six picks go by, and then they trade back again here with the Seahawks. So that's kind of why this is happening, and I think that they probably – are in love with somebody here in the second round, and they still feel like he's going to be available here in a few picks.
Well, that's good. I mean, obviously the Bears are looking best player available, but yesterday we left the draft coverage saying they needed some help on that defensive line. We did see a run on defensive players right at the beginning of the second round, like, as you mentioned, a lot of outside linebackers and defensive players that were projected to be in the first round. It went right away in the second round. Pretty much all the players you had on the Bears board are gone now.
Yeah.
So what would they be looking for in a defensive line situation that might be available at the 56 pick?
Yeah, A'shaun Robinson was the last guy on my Bears big board to go, and he actually went to the Lions at number 46, three picks before the Bears were scheduled to pick at number 49. But obviously that they passed on him because they could have taken him earlier before they traded back with the Bills. A'shaun Robinson was still on the board at that point. So they passed on him, and the Lions end up with him. So that's a guy that the Bears are going to see here for twice a year for a long time if he's a good player. So that's something to think about going forward. Now, Jerron Reed, his teammate at Alabama, still on the board, a defensive lineman. Von Bell, the safety from Ohio State, is still available.
Yeah, that's a guy to keep an eye on.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's guys here that I still think you're getting pretty good value on in the second round, but now we're going to see a few more names come off the board before the Bears pick again. There'll be six more picks before the Bears are back on the clock.
But continuing to move down in the second round says that those guys like Bell and some of the others that are the big names of the draft, they may be looking past those guys because they're going after someone that they know is going to be available at that time.
Yeah, now the interesting thing that played out is that the Packers leapfrogged the Bears right before they were on the clock, and the Packers jumped up to number 48 and took Jason Spriggs, the offensive tackle from Indiana. Good player. I like him a lot. I'm not entirely sure, though, that's the guy the Bears wanted. I think a lot of Bears fans are wondering right now, did the Packers steal one of their guys? I don't know that that's definitely the case, but obviously the Packers felt like they needed to move up to get him.
Right. Okay, well, we'll check back with you, Adam. Obviously, the 56 pick will be coming up a little bit later. The Seahawks are about to select here. We'll check back with you. Thanks for joining us, Adam Hogue, up at Hallis Hall.
I'll be here.
All right. Let's go to Rob Martier, who is, you know, was very graceful in giving up his 4 minutes for us to
Not
talk about Chicago
this is
Bears.
Important stuff, man.
It is. Justin Kaufman here. The Download 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we're going to talk with Jonathan Pitts, the co-founder of the Chicago Improv Festival. And then coming up at 8:30, we're going to talk with Chef Erling Wu Bauer from Nico about his James Beard nomination for Best Chef Great Lakes. We're going to talk to him. It's going to be a fun night tonight here on The Download. But first, let's talk a little politics. The General Assembly has been busy, but not busy in the way we want them to be, meaning approving a state budget, but still they've been busy. One of the big issues that should play out next week is the movement to put a progressive or fair income tax on the November ballot. This is something that many states and the federal government already use, but it needs a vote by next week in the General Assembly to make the ballot for voters to approve it in November. Joining me on the line is Democrat State Representative Will Guzzardi from Chicago. He's part of the movement for a fair progressive tax in Illinois, and he's also a member of the Future Caucus, and we'll ask about the Future Caucus in just a second. Representative Guzzardi, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me on, Justin. How are you doing?
I'm good. So let's talk about this. You know, Eric Zorn wrote about it, you know, that next week is a big, big vote for the General Assembly to take a look at some of the resolutions to put a fair tax or a progressive tax on the ballot come November. This is a big move to generate new revenue.
Yeah, it is. And listen, it's something that I've been advocating for a long time. Illinois is one of only a few states in this country that has a flat income tax. So the end result of that is that the Bruce Rauners of the world are paying way less in taxes than working families in our state. And we got to change that. You know, the federal government has a progressive income tax. Almost every other state in this country does too. It's time for Illinois to get with the times and to lower the income taxes for the vast majority of families in the state, and at the same time raise the billions of dollars in revenue that our state desperately needs to fund some of these social programs.
Now, you'll hear people, and Eric kind of mentioned this in the column too, you'll hear people say, I'm not giving any more money to the state of Illinois until they start cutting all the graft and corruption until they get their act together. We don't want to give them any more money. But as Eric points out, that's already happened in a way. I mean, that's what you guys have been doing for the last couple months to find a way to sort of cut some of the fat.
Well, listen, that's what we've been doing for the last 15 years. I mean, and you know, I think often this is portrayed as a partisan issue, but Democrats aren't blameless here. I mean, Democrats were in control of the General Assembly and the governor's mansion for 12 years, and we saw a long period of slow cuts to social programs and to higher education and to public education. We have seen less funding for social services in the last in this year than we saw, you know, in the mid-2000s by a considerable margin. And the upshot of that is that there isn't any waste left. I mean, in so many of these human service agencies and in the programs that government operates, they've cut to the bone already. And any more cuts, we're talking about ending programs that I think we can all agree are vitally important. So I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of room left for, you know, trimming the fat and lavish excess of state government anymore.
Well, there's been a lot of talk in Springfield about new revenue. Governor Rauner said, you know, we're not going to be able to balance a budget without new revenue. This essentially is new revenue in the way that it would change, and there'd be millions more dollars available for government. But you know, Governor Rauner's not necessarily lining up to change the tax code, is he?
No, I mean, listen, to me, this should be a bipartisan no-brainer. Listen, the proposal that we have here would give a tax break to 99% of Illinois families. It would raise billions of dollars in new revenue for our state. And all it would ask is that the very wealthiest people in Illinois pay a little bit more, pay something closer to their fair share. I think people from every party, people of every political affiliation should support this idea. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like we're going to get a lot of support from the folks across the aisle, and I hope that they're prepared to go defend to their voters at home why they voted against the tax break for 99% of them.
So is that what's happening right now? It seems like this is going to have to get through the General Assembly just to even get on the ballot in November, and right now it's kind of stalled because we're playing partisan politics.
Unfortunately, that's the case, yeah. And, you know, the really, even if you don't agree with the idea, all we're asking to do is to let the voters decide whether they think this is a good idea or not. And you'd think that people of all parties could agree that letting the voters decide on such a thing as this is awfully reasonable. What you have to do is pass it out of the General Assembly with super majorities in both chambers, and then it goes to the voters in November, and you need 60% of voters to agree to it in order to amend the Constitution. So what we're asking for is the opportunity to let the voters decide whether they think that a fair tax is a better system than our current system. I think that's an awfully reasonable thing to ask, and I really hope that we can get folks from
both parties. Have to get? What do you have to get to get to the vote to get it to the people? How many votes do you have to get?
So you need 71 votes in the House, and that's a big challenge. You know, we had exactly 71 Democrats in the House, but a few of my Democratic colleagues are not that keen on this idea. But even if they were, frankly, I would love it if we could do this in a bipartisan way. I think there's a whole lot of folks in Republican districts who rely on social programs, who rely on the universities for employment, who rely on government agencies, whether it's for a job or for services that they need. I think those folks could really use $2 or $3 billion in new revenue to help fund those programs. So I really hope that we can get folks from both parties on board with
this. But the big issue is that, you know, there was a big fight in the primary about the supermajority in the House, 71 mm-hmm. votes. Mm-hmm. You guys have it, but you don't, because there are some Democrats that are not going to vote for this because, in a sense, they see it as either an income tax increase or a tax increase, or they're Ken Duncan. Let's be straight about it.
Right. That's right. I mean, the folks who see this as a tax increase just aren't doing the math. I mean, it's a tax cut for 99% of people. It's just plain and simple. The folks who are Ken Duncan, I can't speak to their motivations, but it seems to me like they tend to be voting on the side of what the governor wants more often than not. So if you think of the governor controlling 48 votes instead of just 47, then that leaves us with 70 of Democrats and not enough to get things like this done without bipartisan support.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Can you stick around for just a second? I'm going to take a real quick break because I want to ask you about the Future Caucus. You're involved in the Future Caucus, which really is a caucus that's interested in the issues and bills that would come up that would help young people, millennials, teenagers even. I'm interested in what you guys are doing. So if you got a second, just stick around. Will Guzzardi, the state representative, Democrat here from Chicago, talking about the progressive tax and also the Future Caucus here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Representative Will Guzzardi from Chicago, Democrat. We're talking about the progressive income tax and whether or not it will be voted to be put on the ballot next in November. The vote has to be next week. We're also talking about the Future Caucus, which this week put some stuff forward about protections, free speech, journalist protections for high school newspapers, things of that nature. Representative Guzzardi, thanks for being with me tonight.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you as always.
So the Future Caucus, tell me about this, because this actually, I missed this, but this was announced this winter, or maybe at the beginning of the
That's
year,
right.
January, February, that you were coming together for the issues of the youth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I went to a conference in, I guess, December in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of legislators from all over the country, millennial state legislators, who were forming these similar called future caucuses in their respective chambers. And what it is it's they're bipartisan groups of young people in the legislature who come together to work on issues facing the next generation. There's 12 other states that have them already. The Congress actually has a Congressional Future Caucus at the federal level, too. So I teamed up with Representative Tom Demmer, who's a Republican. So he and I are the co-founders of it. And we have 12 members, I think, members from both parties, people who are young and who are interested in advancing the issues that that will help move the state forward for the next generation of young people.
Is that harder to do when the state needs all hands on deck to work on a state budget? I mean, is it hard to say,
yeah.
Oh, no, we're gonna work on, you know, hunting license for kids under 18. I mean, I understand
right.
that stuff is important, and I don't want to trivialize any of that stuff, but it does feel like, you know, the issues that affect millennials and younger people are also state budget.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Look, of course we need a solution to the budget, and people of all ages need that. I don't propose this as if to say that this is somehow more important, but I do think it's important for the people of the state to see that amidst this terrible gridlock and this partisanship and this infighting, that there are people who do go down to Springfield and have an eye toward a different and better kind of politics. Mm-hmm. And especially if the next generation of folks who are going to take the reins of our politics in 10, 15, 20 years, that we have a different way of going about business. That instead of gridlock and partisanship, what we're interested in is finding compromise and consensus and making meaningful steps forward. And yeah, we're not going to fix the budget, just us. Eventually we'll be a part of the solution. But in the meantime, we want to show people in Illinois that stuff can get done, and it can get done in a bipartisan, collaborative way.
Well, I mean, you're in a position where, you know, a lot of, frankly, a lot of younger voters, a lot of younger Illinois residents are turned off by state government. They're not paying attention because every day they turn on, you know, any of the sources that they're getting for their, they're checking out Snapchat news. and they don't like what they see. So how do you reach them, and how do you find out and represent the issues of a population that may not be interested in politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually the big peril of this. And again, why I think that what we're doing with the Future Caucus is important. I think the big peril of the partisan gridlock that has been the sort of domain of Washington for some time and has now really come to Illinois in the last couple of years. The peril is that young people will look at politics and decide that it's not a worthwhile field for them to engage in. It's just broken and dysfunctional, and it's not worth their time or energy. And that would be a tremendous loss. I think that the issues facing my generation, our generation, yours and mine, man, they are colossal, and they require enormous engagement and activity. And if we just throw up our hands and decide that government and politics can't solve it, we're screwed, to be totally honest.
Yeah, right.
So I think there's young people stepping up and being role models in the legislature and showing that there's for lack of a better phrase, we can be the grown-ups in the room. I think that's really important. I think it's an important lesson to send to the young people who are watching state government to say our generation can lead, and we can lead better.
Yeah. We'll pay attention to this because I think there's some interesting things that are coming out. And when they come to vote, we'll have you back. State Representative Will Guzzardi, a Democrat from Chicago, joining us to talk about the Future Caucus, but also about the progressive tax vote, which should be on Tuesday if it happens, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to go up on Tuesday, and I'm really excited about it. I'd be happy to come back on and debrief
all right.
it post.
I love it. That's a promise. Right. We'll talk to you. Thanks, Representative.
Appreciate it. All right. Yeah, I'll talk to you real soon.
All right.
And before we take a look at the forecast,
yeah,
Justin, the Bears pick is
Let's
in.
Let's bring in Adam Hogue. He's up at Hallis Hall. Adam, the pick is in for the Chicago Bears. What are we looking at?
Yeah, guys, it's Cody Whitehair out of Kansas State, an offensive guard. Little surprising here.
Huh.
Good, solid player. Saw him at the Senior Bowl. I like them. I'm a little surprised they go guard here, especially because we know Kyle Long is moving back to guard. Matt Slauson's on this team. So maybe he could play center.
Yeah, I was going to say center or possible that Kyle Long stays at tackle. Well, I mean, they proved last year, Adam, that they're going to move out Kyle Long wherever he wants to play. But but is it surprising? I mean, where was this guy on the depth chart?
It's a Where was Cody Whitehair?
No, I mean, where was he, like, on the draft board?
He was a second-round talent. I think he's a good player, and I think that I liked him a lot. Like I said, when I was down at Senior Bowl, I saw him, and it's a little surprising when you look at the Bears' depth chart, but Ryan Pace said this, they're going to go with best player available, and that's they traded back here twice, and I think we got to go back to the last time they traded back, and the Packers leapfrogged them at the last second and took Jason Spriggs, the offensive tackle from Indiana, which was more of a position of need for the Bears. I mean, I like Charles Leno. I think the Bears like Charles Leno's potential, but I think Jason Spriggs maybe has a little bit higher ceiling in the long run. And Bobby Massey, who they signed from Arizona, isn't necessarily a sure thing on the right side. So, it would have made a little bit more sense, I think, to bring in a tackle rather than a guard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Packers made that move. It'll be interesting to hear what Ryan Pace says here when we get a chance to talk to him later tonight about this whole thing. I have a feeling he's not going to admit that the Packers stole their pick by any means. But this is who they end up with. Cody Whitehair, I think, is a solid player and adds some depth to an offensive line that didn't have a whole lot of depth at guard last season.
Adam, the answer to this question might be obvious, but do teams do this to create competition at training camp?
Absolutely, and that's a huge, you know, Ryan Pace, we said that on Wednesday here at Hallis Hall, that the competition is really the key word for their offseason, I think. So, you know, it's hard to, if you like a player, and like I said, I do like Cody Whitehair. It's hard to criticize a pick, even if it's not necessarily the greatest position of need. If it's a good player, then you like adding him to the mix.
You know, Adam, I was going to say, I mean, this is the team, Ryan Pace in his, you know, second year, John Fox in his second year, they're rebuilding for the future. Can you see a player like Whitehair taking over for a Slauson who's getting up there in age? This is really almost like tantamount to what they do with quarterbacks, where he's going to learn, he's going to play, but at the same time, you know, he will be the future of the franchise.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think Matt Slauson has really been their best offensive lineman the last couple of years. Most consistent. He had the injury, but he switched over to center last year kind of seamlessly in a dire situation and performed very well. So I'm as curious as anybody to see here what happens with Matt Slauson eventually.
Let's go to the auditorium theater because they're doing the big – I want to see if they boo. Hold on, let's see.
By members of Chicago's Wendell Phillips Academy football team.
Yeah, Phillips High. There you go.
Undefeated last year, the first Chicago Public League high school to win the Illinois State Championship. Congratulations to the team and Coach Troy McAllister. Congratulations, guys. To announce the Chicago Bears selection, please welcome from the University of Illinois, the third overall pick in the 1965 draft by the Bears, 1979 Hall of Fame inductee, linebacker Dick Butkus.
There you go. Oh, darn it, I thought it was going to be Cap Boso.
All right, with the 56th pick in the 2016 NFL draft, the Chicago Bears select Cody Whitehair, guard from Kansas State. All right.
Ooh, Butkus likes it. Butkus likes it, Adam. Did you hear that? He'd give it a little right.
He seemed to like it a little bit. I like him. He played left tackle for Kansas State the last couple of years. Okay. I just don't know if he's a tackle. So, hey, maybe the Bears try him out there.
Right.
I think we're going to see a lot of things on the offensive line during OTAs and mini camp and going into training camp with the guys playing multiple spots, really as the Bears try to find their best combination of five guys. So maybe he starts getting reps there in the offseason. They see what he can do at tackle before they try him at guard. But ultimately, I think his best position in the NFL is at guard.
All right. There you heard it. Cody Whitehair, offensive guard from Kansas State. We will check back in with you, Adam, a little bit later, see if anything else happens in the second round. Obviously, the third round still in play for the Chicago Bears. Adam, thanks for joining us, and thanks for giving us the update.
All right. No problem.
How about that? The NFL draft continues to amaze. Let's shift gears. Starting on Monday, it's the 19th Chicago Improv Festival. The festival's given us great comedy over the years, including headliners like Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Upright Citizens Brigade, Key and Peele. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. It really has been one of the highlights of the last 19 years. I mean, every single year, it's something that people seek out. It's back for its 19th year, but this year, as in the last couple of years, it's changed direction, philosophy, and size. Jonathan Pitts, the co-founder of the festival, is with me in studio. Good to see you, Jonathan.
Good to see you, Justin.
All right, how are you? Hold on one second here.
Freud.
Yeah, there we go. That's right. I full disclosure, I have performed in the Chicago Improv Festival many years. For you, 19 years. I mean, I mentioned some of these people coming through, but right now, I mean, a couple days before the Improv Fest, I mean, you're pretty stressed out.
Yes.
What does it take to run an improv festival in Chicago?
Well, it takes a lot of ambassadorship because we're working with so many different theaters. We're working with so much different talent. It's also having to take into consideration the audience, which is part of the reason for the shift in the artistic focus, because once we got above 100 groups in the festival, it turned into potpourri for the general public. Unless they were related to somebody, they couldn't tell what to pick. So I took a page from Milwaukee Summerfest, because I love that they have different venues based on different artistic things. So if you want to go see bluegrass, you go to the one bluegrass stage. If you're like, screw that, I want to go hear heavy metal, you go over there. So 3 years ago, we came up with the idea of having different artistic categories within improv. Now, for the average person, like, wait, improv is just funny. Yes, it is. But there's so many different types of ways of doing it now, no longer based on size, like here's a duo, here's not. There's all musical groups. There's groups that do genre, like improvised Shakespeare or improvised Twilight Zone. There's groups that do experimental and alternative stuff. There's groups that just like doing short-form games, like on what you see on Whose Line. So it made it a lot easier to come up with these 7 or 8 different artistic categories, mm-hmm. because then somebody who goes to our website can just choose what they want to go see.
What they like to see.
Yeah, and then we set it all up at 1 or 2 theaters. So now it fits your schedule. Like if you're like, I got Friday night available, I can only go see a show at 10:30, but I like improvised music. Now you can just go to MCL Chicago and see that. So it's becoming more audience friendly, as even, and that in its own way has allowed us to get even bigger.
Let's get back to 1997. Okay. This is when you're starting off.
Yes.
What? Why did you get into the festival game? What was it about? What were you thinking about when you were in Chicago in 1997? And why were you thinking, okay, Chicago needs this?
I would be working. I first got my start on festivals, the International Theater Festival, which was originally created by Jane Nichols Solins, Bernie Solins' wife. And that ran for about 10 years. And I was a production intern. And it was my first introduction to festivals. And I was like, this is amazing to see people from all over the world doing theater work. Later on, I got invited to become the theater and performance curator of the Around the Coyote. And I did that for 7 years. And which
that's
is
a great festival. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's really where I cut my teeth. And then I started doing other festivals like the Bailiwick Directors Festival. I did a Shakespeare festival up in Michigan. And I did a visual arts festival. And so I started doing all these different festivals. And that sort of started becoming my gig. And I was working on a children's festival that Maggie Daly had put together called Magic City, which existed for a couple of years. And Francis Callier was working on that. And of course, that's when Francis and I met. And I was looking at the big festival in America for improv, which at that time was in Austin, Texas, called the Big Stinkin'.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, wait, with Chicago's history of festivals, with Chicago's history of being the mecca and birthplace of this, why is there not a festival in Chicago? So I had the idea. I asked Frances, and she said she'd been wanting to do it for years, but no one would ever do it with her. And then we both agreed we had to be, like, independent. Because, you know...
Well, this town is Second City and Improv Olympic and those kind of places.
Annoyance and Comedy Store. Right. I always call them like the mafia families. They have claimed their territory and each one... It took them years to get peace, you know, and now... So we had to be Sweden. We had to be the ambassadors and embrace every style of improvisation that exists out there and make room for everybody at the tent.
Well, it seemed to me that the Chicago Improv Festival... was very what came around at the right time because right at that time you're talking about some of the entertainers and improvisers that are now household names who are doing American Express commercials were the people who were available
just hanging around
going, I'd love to be in the festival. So you were able to get an early sort of Upright Citizens Brigade to be on stage. You're able to get Tina Fey and
Seth Meyers, Ike Barinholtz, the names that just go on and on. You look at year 3, which is the first year that Chatham Freud played. That's the year that was just stupidly amazing. Jason Sudeikis performed in it. Mm-hmm. There are so many people that performed. Jack McBrayer before he was known, T.J. Jagodowski. You know, part of what I've always felt is with the Chicago Improv Festival, we get people 5 minutes ahead of the curve. We get Key and Peele just before they start shooting their whole season. And then we can't see them again for 5 years. So it's like if you want to see the people who are just about to hit, you go to CCIF because they're here just before they hit and then they just blow up.
Yeah, and I know this because I was around at that time and I talked to you at that time about what it takes to put a festival together. But, you know, it's very difficult to get top-notch talent to come back from Los Angeles and New York on your timetable, meaning it's on May 1st or May 2nd, and you're like, I'd love to have the Saturday Night Live cast member, but there's a Saturday show. We can't move the festival. There's a lot that
And it's even harder now because in L.A. they're shooting all the time. because of everything that's happening with cables and everything that's happening with Netflix.
So it used to be you were finding
a
spot, right?
Yes,
right.
And now everybody shoots, you know, at different points. Teachers, the group, which is actually the Katie Dids,
yeah,
who
right.
was our headliners last year, they're shooting their episodes right now. So, I mean, now in Hollywood, there really is no downtime. The good news is that so many people that we know are in a position to either create shows or are doing shows, and there's so much more work for the people that we know. But in terms of trying to schedule certain...
Does that also factor into the idea to slim it down, to not do the big sort of, you know, huge stages at the Athenaeum where you have all these big headliners?
It's just it's a and huge part of what we also found out, because also it's sort of my job to listen to the artists. And part of what I found out is a lot of the artists were not comfortable in a 950-seat theater. So what I've sort of learned is that the average artist, the really talented artist, someone like a Susan Messing, she prefers to be in what I would call an off-Broadway size house, something that's like 300 seats, that's bigger than her normal show. But once you get up to 950, she loses that intimacy and doesn't enjoy it as much. And a lot of the groups felt that way. So I was like, okay, great. There's something about the artists of this work that prefer off-Broadway size venues than Broadway. And when I think about it, you know, because what you did with Schadenfreude, every time you guys performed on the main stage in front of 950 people, it was spectacle upon spectacle, which fit that size.
Well, you had to, because that was what the venue was.
Right.
Otherwise, you couldn't go in and do your black box.
No, you couldn't. Right.
Let's take a quick break so we can get back on time here. Jonathan Pitts, the co-founder of the Chicago Improv Festival, starts on Monday. It's the 19th Chicago Improv Festival. We'll talk about some of the highlights, what to expect from the festival coming up after the break. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Jonathan Pitts is in studio with me, the co-founder of the Chicago Improv Festival, which is celebrating its 19th year, starting Monday. 21 different venues, over 100 different shows. Improv takes over next week. You know, for you, I mean, this I remember with the festival when I did shows earlier, 15, now it's been 15 years, man. That's crazy to think about.
Right?
But there was a lot of industry.
Yes.
You had, you know, scouts that came out. I know that Seth Meyers was first seen by SNL scout on the stage at your festival.
And we used to have scouting come in from NBC, ABC, CBS. That's also back when there was very few other stations.
Right.
And they used to come, and we used to have to do all we could to take care of them. But, you know, with the growth of like UCB on the East Coast and the West Coast, they don't seem to come out very much anymore, except for the SNL showcases that Annoyance and Second City and IO puts up. So now it seems like if Chicago acts want to get seen, they're making their own webisodes, which is part of why, like,
Or they got to move.
Or they make webisodes and then they move.
Isn't that strange, like, to think about that in 2016 when access is at the fingertips?
Right.
That it's actually become a little bit constrictive, meaning that, you know, like UCB has been able to open up on both coasts, and the industry seems to have gotten smaller when the avenues are bigger.
Yes, and it's very odd, too. And it also doesn't make sense to me that more stuff isn't happening in Chicago, because you have all those, you know, Chicago Fire, Chicago Police Department, Chicago police shows.
Right.
So if the industry is willing to come here for that, why are some of the other shows that we know that could happen aren't happening?
Maybe it's a precursor to a boom here.
I would love to see that.
You know, for you, I mean, the festival is business.
I mean,
you know, this is not a it has fluctuated from for-profit to not-for-profit over the years.
Right.
I mean, you as an artist, as an improviser, as someone who did production, had to learn how to be a businessman pretty quick, especially surrounding yourself with artists and others who all want a piece of something.
Yeah, and one of the things that I learned is that being a not-for-profit, part of what I say is not everything has to make money, but nothing can lose money. You know, and so there are certain things that we can do for the artistic good of it, either for the art or for the audience, but we can't lose money at it, because if we lose money, we can't keep coming back. And so that's sort of like the overall philosophy with that, rather than how do we get every single penny out of it. But at the same time, we stretch every single dollar, and a lot of it comes from – this is still a passion project for a lot of people, not necessarily the people who work on the Chicago Improv production staff, but the mm-hmm. people that we all work with.
Right.
It still ties into passion. It would be hard to operate that way year round, but because it's a 1 week thing, so many people are willing to pitch in.
Right.
You know, it's like the improv equation of raising a barn.
Right. You're the Amish of Chicago performers.
Yeah, except for everyone's wearing plaid shirts.
Right. He's got a beer in their hand.
That's right.
Doing it, making up stuff.
Right.
Sweeping across the stage.
Yep.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the highlights of this festival, because, you know, one thing that's always interesting about the Improv Festival is, you know, you do go, I mean, you've gone out of your way over the 19 years to bring in international acts, to bring in, I remember the, what was the Japanese group?
Yeah, Yellow Man Group.
Yellow Man Group, right. but you've had, but you've, and you've done a lot with cultivating relationships with college, and
yeah.
I know so many people who have come up to me over the years with Schadenfreude and said, I saw you at the show. I was at this college or that college, and I was coming to the Improv Festival with my troupe, you know, and we saw you there. And I realize it's, there really is a connection to kids, the university level, improv, and international.
That's part of the reason why we have a college improv tournament that we do every year. This year we had 136 teams competing in 14 regionals across the country. And then just last Saturday we had our nationals with bracket style, 14 teams.
How do you organize that, Jonathan? How do you put that together, man? What are you doing? Like, how do you do that? That's I mean, you have tournaments in different areas.
Yes, we
like
do.
You're like the NCAA.
Yes, that's exactly what we are.
For college improv.
Yeah. This year's national champs are from the University of Iowa, and they're called Paperback Rhino. And
when do you sleep, man?
I have insomnia.
All right, so what's the highlight? What are the highlights this week?
Well, this year we've had a lot of records broken. We have 105 shows, over 170 acts, people from 9 countries performing at 21 venues. So it's so much. Simplest thing is just go to our website, chicagoimprovfestival.org, to check that out. But okay. As far as what I'm excited about.
Yeah, what are you excited about?
I love that on our opening night, we have an all-women's groups. We have Children of a Lesser God with Susan Messing, and we have Rachel, and we also have Emily Candini's coming back. Yeah. She performs with them. She's just now signed something. She's going to be taping a new show with Comedy
awesome.
Central.
That's great.
So she's going to be on that
awesome.
There. So we got Rachel
she's
Mason.
She's hilarious.
Yeah, we have a all...
Mason and Messing, I wish I knew who they were. I wish they they do a lot of bits with us.
Yes,
on
they
the
do.
Show. That's,
and we have also the middle act for that is called Woke AF! Exclamation mark, and it's 5 African American women from the Bob Curry Fellowship who have joined together to improvise.
Okay,
and then we have Virgin Daiquiri. So you know,
another great group. Yeah.
Yeah. So on opening night, it's really nice to be able to showcase that we have these strong, powerful, smart, funny, talented women who are great improvisers. And we're putting them front and foremost.
Jonathan Pitts is the co-founder of the Chicago Improv Festival. The festival is celebrating its 19th season, I guess you would say.
Sure,
it's
yeah.
The 19th Chicago Improv Festival starts Monday, 21 different venues. What's the website?
ChicagoImprovFestival.org.
Okay, Jonathan, great to see you. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about all the hijinks you and I have been involved with in the last 20 years. We've had some great spectacle theater together.
Well, I'd love to have Schadenfreude come back next year for year 20. That's right. Seriously.
That would be fun.
Seriously.
You'd have to get Kate out of L.A. That would be the hard part. And Sandy's, well, Sandy's in Canada.
If we steal her child, she'll follow.
Jonathan, thanks for coming in, man.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tonight we continue our week-long series showcasing some of the chefs and restaurateurs who are up for a James Beard Award. The awards take place right here in Chicago on Monday night. One category that will be sure to bring Chicago a Beard Award is Best Chef Great Lakes. Every nominee in the category is from here, and that includes Chef Erling Wu Bauer. He's the chef at Nico Asteria, the critically acclaimed Italian seafood restaurant on Rush Street. Erling Wu Bauer is up for his second James Beard Award in this category. He was nominated last year. His resume is pretty impressive, working with some of the great Chicago chefs, including Rick Bayless and Paul Kahn, among others. Chef Wu Bauer, thanks for joining us tonight on The Download. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what's it mean to be nominated? I mean, this is second time around. It's this old hat for you, right?
Yeah, not necessarily, especially with the awards being in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to be nominated? First of all, it's a huge honor for the city, but also for me and the restaurant. I think it's more than anything else. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say I don't like it. I think it's a badge of pride that all of the cooks and all of the front of the house people who work here can wear. And ideally, for us, it makes us a little bit busier, too, would be the idea, you know?
Is that how it's perceived, I mean, at your restaurant? I mean, it's not just a nomination for you, but it's a nomination for everybody who works with you, around you, for you, who does this night in and night out.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, this is not one single restaurant that I've ever worked at has been a solo effort, especially a restaurant of this size. I mean, I have an incredible team of chefs. I have an incredible team of cooks, and without them, I mean, we would not be in business. So, yeah, to think that it's an individual award is just, it's just nonsense. It's really a team award, and I really try to make the team feel as proud of the award as possible every day.
Well, the restaurant you work in is tremendous. Nico's one of my favorite restaurants, and I will say
thank you so much.
Yep, and I will say that you know, you can tell that obviously bringing seafood. There are a lot of seafood restaurants in Chicago, and it's not just seafood, but the idea of what you guys prepare and how you prepare it is very fresh. Talk about working in seafood, preparing seafood in a city like Chicago, where you know even 10 years ago, it was a lot harder to do what you guys were doing in this market.
You know, it's an interesting question. The birth of idea was kind of a conversation between me, Donnie Medea, and Paul Kahn, two of the owners of One Off Hospitality, the company that owns Nico. And when I first brought them the idea of a seafood restaurant in Chicago, they almost kind of laughed me out of the room because it's such a meat and potatoes type of town.
And it's hard to get great seafood. I mean, the seafood that you guys are preparing and bringing in, you got to ship it in.
For sure. And those shipping lines didn't necessarily exist 10 to 12 years ago. They've kind of just appeared as Chicago has matured as a culinary destination. I think the companies that grow that type of ocean produce realize that getting fish to Chicago is really important. I mean, working with it is a pleasure. It actually makes my job really, really easy. When you bring in stuff that nice and all you have to do is cut it and put it on a plate and just garnish it very simply to make it taste good, it's one of the things that really brings joy to my day, and it also, you know, it makes me look good, which I like, you know?
I mean, you guys are, it's not just, you know, getting lobster and scallops off of a truck. I mean, you guys are working with a lot of exotic fish, but also, you know, some fish that's hard to find in this area. Talk about, you know, your background in seafood and in fish before working at Nico.
I think my background in seafood would have to start with the fact that I'm absolutely addicted to fishing, human being. I mean, my grandfather and my mother were actually really responsible for teaching me how to fish when I was really little, and I fell in love with fishing. And, you know, I fished every time I go on vacation. If it's near an ocean, I have to go fishing. I used to fish Lake Michigan as much as I possibly could in the lakes and the surrounding area. So that's number one. For some reason, you know, the cutting of fish and the kind of like holding of seafood just always really appealed to me. I think one of the things that really appealed to me was it's a delicateness and the type of handling that it requires. I was really turned on by that. And also the kind of whole culture of preparing fish and cutting fish from the Japanese to the Italians. I read about it a lot. I studied it a lot along with my studying of fishing. And that's kind of how the obsession of fish was kind of born. And then I think the next really important step was Rick Bayless kind of really mentored me on how good fish could be and how good really sustainable and hard to find seafood could be. And then if we could fast forward again to the opening of the Publican was, mm-hmm. You know, on its onset, it was a oyster, pork, and beer restaurant. But we really kind of, as me, Brian Houston, and Paul Kahn were developing that concept, we kind of decided that we really wanted to focus heavily on seafood, too. And if you go to the Publican even still today, I mean, certainly there's a lot of pork and there's a lot of oysters, but there's a ton of seafood there, too. And so we would get seafood from California in three times a week from this purveyor called Monterey Seafood in San Francisco. They're right on the dock, right by the ocean there, and they get some of the most beautiful West Coast seafood you could ever imagine from really sustainable small fishermen. And we'd get that in, and just the experimentation with that box that came in three times a week from Monterey Seafood really started to get me thinking about not just how to cook seafood, but how to get seafood, how to get the freshest seafood. And that's kind of how the process made it all the way over here to Nico.
That's great to hear. I mean, to think about not just, you know, how you prepare the food, but to really get into perfecting or pouring over how the food gets here. That's something that we'd like to hear. You know, you have two trainings really in your life, the training of your family. Your family was in food or taught you how to fish, taught you how to cook. And then also, you know, the mentorships and the chefs that you worked under. You mentioned Rick Bayless and also Paul Kahn. Let's start with your family. What drew you to getting into the kitchen?
Yeah, my mom was a food writer, and my dad is Creole, and you know, so I really didn't have any choice. You know, the conversation at breakfast was what was for dinner, and the conversation at dinner was what was for breakfast. So, you know, this is kind of the way it went. I mean, we were, you know, there was no TV during dinner. We ate together. We cooked together. We made pasta together. We cooked crawfish etouffee together. We made gumbo together. And that was just life. Life was based around the table and the kitchen. And I wouldn't have it any other way. So, you know, I really never thought of any other profession. It just was the natural thing. It was just a natural thing to go into. And then my mother was a really good friend, luckily, of Rick Bayless. And he, from when I was 6 or 7, I think saw a spark, culinary spark in me, and just really nurtured that spark until the point when I got a job with Paul.
You talk about those chefs, but Rick Bayless, I mean, obviously we know him as a chef of Mexican food. He's obviously one of the biggest premier chefs in this area in the country. I mean, beyond Mexican food, what did he teach you?
I think the most important lesson and kind of my major food philosophy is that, you know, you should bring in beautiful things and do as little as possible to them. And that definitely started with Rick. I didn't understand what great ingredients were until we started cooking together. And you know, he was the first person who had me taste Yukon River King Salmon, which unfortunately you almost can't get anymore. But, you know, when you eat an ingredient like that, your eyes are open to just what's out there and how important it is to find the really good stuff. And as I said, do very little to it. I mean, Rick really excels at, you know, throwing something on his wonderful wood grill and putting a beautiful sauce over it, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's doing a disservice to his cuisine. It's actually not that simple. There's way more preparation that goes into, but that's the kind of idea behind it. And he was the first one that really turned me on to simplicity and ingredient driven cuisine.
You know, the restaurants that you moved on to, Publican, of course, Publican Quality Meats across the street, and Nico, where you're at now, those are some of the premier restaurants that are in Chicago as we speak, as this town transforms from not just a good culinary town, but to a great one. You guys and One Off Hospitality have been a big part of that. Talk about, you know, being a part of Publican when Publican took off, because that restaurant, I mean, it exploded.
Yeah, it definitely did. Don't forget Avec in there, too.
Yeah, right. Sorry. I apologize, Avec, too.
It's okay. I mean, one of the things that people often forget about the Publican that I like to talk about is that it opened in the middle of the recession. And so when we opened, we were terrified. I mean, we were opening at the worst possible time because the recession really had just set in. And it was just a testament to the uniqueness and quality of the cuisine, of Brian and Paul's cuisine, that we were able to weather that storm. You know, that winter was bleak in the eyes of a lot of restaurants, but because we were new and because we really concentrated on quality, it really made it. I think the great thing about that restaurant is, you know, besides One-Off's belief in great food, was just the uniqueness of the concept, right? I just think oysters, pork, and beer. It sounds right. Sounds so elemental and so obvious, yet nobody had really quite gripped onto it like we had there.
Well, it almost feels exactly what you said about Bayless, the concept of, you know, finding beautiful, fresh, you know, great food and being able to, I mean, the idea of an oyster, you know, pork and beer bar. Yes, I mean, that's essentially what it is, but there's something about the mixture and the atmosphere and the ambiance and the food that just comes together. It seems a lot more exotic than just, you know, beer, pork, and oysters.
And it certainly is. And I mean, certainly Paul is also a major champion of that food philosophy, too, of just like the simplicity of ingredients and not getting in their way before they get to the plate. It is. I mean, the Publican is definitely more complex than just oysters, pork, and beer. It's a concept that borrows a lot from a lot of different cultures, yet when it gets to the plate, it all makes sense, which is rare. You know, it's not fusion food, it's American food. And I think that might be one of the things, certainly what Paul would say, and I'm not saying it because he says it, I do agree with him, it's an American restaurant. I just think it's completely and totally authentic to what it is, you know, and I actually think that's rare. I think a lot of other concepts might be a little bit forced or might be a little bit too rigid. It just, like, the Publican is unafraid to wear the clothes that it wears every day, right? It's not self-conscious whatsoever, which is kind of what I think draws people to it in the end.
Yeah, right. And I got to ask, you know, being a cook, being a chef in that environment, I mean, the standing room only, when I think of Avec, I think, you know, like, I mean, it is turnover. What did you learn working in those kitchens when it's not just about a hot restaurant? You're really talking about, you know, almost overdrive. What did you take away from your experiences in those restaurants?
All the time. You know, I think as a young cook, you're really, you're probably over, you are over obsessed with making things look pretty and quality, and you don't realize that there's a business side to these things too. And working in those two restaurants, you have no choice but to realize very fast that not only does the food have to taste good and look beautiful, but it also has to get out at lightning pace in order to make people happy too. And I just think, especially at a place like Avec, I mean, Avec, believe it or not, is actually, it's not, the pace of Avec is utterly insane.
And
you just realize that the happiness of a diner doesn't just have to do with, you know, food and the way it tastes. It has to do with how fast that food gets to them. So
yep.
I think that was one of the main things. And, you know, but it also makes you, I always tell my cooks, like, all I care about is how good the food tastes, but just get it to me as fast as possible. Okay. Right. Like that's
what you have on a typeface on the wall in the Nico kitchen.
That's what I learned for at Publican and Avec.
All right. So let me ask you as we wrap up here, Chicago, obviously the home of the Beards now, at least for this year, you know, obviously a huge culinary town just by the fact that this category, Best Chef Great Lakes, is all Chicago chefs. What does it mean for you to be working in Chicago right now with this sort of culinary boom?
That's a very good question. I'm very excited to be in Chicago right now for this culinary boom. I am really excited, especially to see the independent restaurant kind of pop up back on the map. I mean, for some people that aren't nominated, if I could plug them, people like Gene Cato at Sumo Rabada Bar and people like Sarah Grunenberg at Monte Verde and restaurants like Beverly Kim's restaurant, Parachute. Restaurants like that popping back up, that really gets me excited and proud to be in Chicago as well as the people who are nominated. I mean, how does it make me feel? Honored more than anything else, honored to be, you know, mentioned in the same sentence as Curtis Duffy and Andrew Zimmerman. Super excited for Lee Woolen. He and I mean, I'm friends with all of these guys, but, you know, Lee and I are really good friends, and I'm just like really excited to be nominated together. Abe Conlon, like, it's a tiny little restaurant way out there, and he's nominated to be, you know, Best Chef Great Lakes. I mean, I think that's really exciting for Chicago that, like, the little guys are there too, like the independent guys. And I think it's really inspiring to all the cooks out there. I mean, it's going to keep for a long time. You know, when two of our best regulars came to me after I opened up Nico, they were like, "This is so good. Like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? You're not going to leave anytime soon, are you? Like, you're not going to leave the city anytime soon, are you?" And I think there was this consistent fear of chefs in Chicago that they were going to go to New York or go to San Francisco or go to Austin. And I think there's enough excitement here right now that, I mean, I'm not going anywhere. I don't think any of these other guys are going anywhere. And so I think we're just, to be honest with you, I just think we're at the beginning of another seminal moment in Chicago cuisine, and I'm just happy to play a very small role in it and kind of go along for the ride.
I love it. That's a good answer. We are at the beginning. Chef Erling Wu Bauer, he's a chef at Nico Osteria. He's up for Best Chef Great Lakes. Every nominee in the category is from Chicago. The James Beard are on Monday night at the Civic Opera House. Erling Wu Bauer, thanks for being my guest tonight.
You're very welcome.
And
thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Before we go any further, Justin, I guess the Bears now are on the clock
Yeah, the pick's in. Let's go to Adam Hoge, who's up at Hallis Hall. He's got the pick. Adam, what are we looking at for the Bears in the third round?
Yeah, guys, the Bears have taken Jonathan Bullard from Florida, defensive lineman, 6'3", 285 pounds. Interesting guy, kind of a tweener a little bit. I'm not exactly sure, you know, where they're going to want him on this defensive line, but he is talented, has some upside, I think, and one of those guys that's always working on every snap. So Bears draft Jonathan Bullard in the third round, and we'll see if they're done here. So far this is the last pick they have, but then now they have all these fourth rounders. Theoretically, they could trade up again.
Yeah, right. Well, this was a need that they had sort of targeted. Where does Bullard fall on the on your rankings when it comes to defensive end?
Yeah, I mean, he's far enough back they don't have a specific spot for him.
Yeah.
A little bit surprised he's going this early, but I mean, a lot of people thought he could go in the second round. So I think this is kind of in general kind of where he belongs. And again, I like the talent. I'm kind of feel like he's a better fit in a 4-3 defense. The Bears obviously run a 3-4, but you know, I heard Ryan Pace talk the other day. that they're in sub packages with four down linemen enough that that's not necessarily a line drawn where they can't draft maybe one gap players who are better fit in a 4-3 defense. So I think he's going to find a way to get on the field for the Bears.
All right, there you go. Jonathan Bullard from Florida, defensive end, the number third round choice for the Chicago Bears here in the draft. If they don't make any more moves, this will end their night, and tomorrow they've got a slew of fourth rounders. But you're right, they could move up if they see somebody they want in the third round. We'll keep our eyes on it and keep Adam Hoag close by. Adam, thanks, man.
I will keep you guys posted.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Now that we've talked to the nominees for the Beard Awards, let's bring in the man, Steve Dolinsky, the Hungry Hound from ABC 7, where you can catch him on the news at 4 o'clock on Fridays or 10 o'clock on Saturdays. He's here to preview the awards to find out who he thinks will take home the big James Beards on Monday. Steve is not nominated for a James Beard this year.
It's travesty.
Don't even get me started. I think that's either an accounting error. It's got to be like maybe they switch computer systems. That could be. Or maybe they just got together and they're like, we can't give Steve Dolinsky his 14th James Beard Award.
They're like, isn't it good enough we're doing the awards in Chicago? Do we have to actually give awards to Chicagoans? My God.
Steve, good to see you.
Good Thanks to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
Our Chicago is well represented in this James Beard, especially in the category of Best Chef Great Lakes. We've talked to some of the chefs. We had Andrew Zimmerman in here. Erling Wubauer was just before. Lee Wolin earlier in the week. What do you think of this? I mean, finally, last year I kind of got mad, remember, because Cleveland won.
Yeah. Although,
but finally they figured this out.
He's a good guy, though, in Cleveland, by the way.
I know. Everybody says that, but I don't believe it.
By the way, I'm just curious. Zimmerman say, hey, how many times a day he gets misidentified with Andrew Zimmern from Bizarre Foods? That is a big problem. People come into the restaurant.
Really?
I swear to God, they come to Sepia. I've heard this from other people. Where's the bald guy who eats the bugs? Is he the chef here? No, Andrew Zimmerman, not Zimmern. Zimmerman. So
now, he's been nominated a couple times now, and he hasn't won. Is this his year?
Zimmerman? Boy. Well, I know somebody from Chicago is going to win the Great Lakes right. Best Chef category, so I'm going to go on the line and say, yes, that'll be Chicago. I think because Curtis Duffy didn't win it last year from Grace, he's kind of the odds-on favorite. That's okay. Really the – I mean, because Grace is really – it's a little bit apples and oranges in terms of like Sepia and Grace, and they're all Fat Rice, very different restaurants. But in terms of, I think – technical skill, you got to look at someone like Curtis Duffy. They're all talented. But, you know, Conlon, what he does is so different, and he's making his own sausage, and he's reinterpreting Macanese cuisine, and what Erling is doing, making his own pasta and, you know, cooking this beautiful, pristine fish. Although some would argue once you have a beautiful product like this fish from Sardinia, you don't need to do too much to it.
Right,
a lot of these chefs say just leave it alone,
yeah, right?
But I think what Curtis is doing is really, you know, altering the course of these ingredients.
No,
he's really changing things around.
It's surprising because, I mean, obviously this is the category, but Grace is in a different category when it comes to almost fine dining. I mean, you would almost put Grace at the same level as Alinea as opposed to Fat Rice or Sepia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely more tweezer food than it is like just sort of get your hands in there, get dirty and, you know, screaming and like there's things bubbling and steaming. And no, it's very precise, very, very analytical, very technical. And Curtis has been doing this for years. He was at the Peninsula. He was at Avenues. Worked for Grant Achatz for quite a while. And I just think, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Grace. It's not my favorite restaurant. It's just a little bit too precious for me. But it certainly is deserving of accolades and what he is doing. The guy is supremely talented and has an amazing path. By the way, the documentary that Kevin Pang did about him for Grace was nominated this past week at the Beards in New York, which is a separate, the Book Broadcast Journalism Awards. Don't even start me on this one. But he did not win that. He was up for Best Documentary, which I thought he for sure should have won.
Right.
I don't even know who won that one. Somebody from New York probably. But, so the Book Broadcast Journalisms are a week before in New York, and then the Restaurant Awards are here in Chicago.
Is there – I mean, we talked about this last year, about that – that split really is almost a lobby move by the publishing companies and stuff, because they're from New York. They're there, mm-hmm. and they're like, we're not going to Chicago. You're going to keep them here. We're going to do the broadcast and the books and the publishing stuff here. But Rahm Emanuel is able to get the chefs and the restaurateurs and more of the foodie awards to Chicago.
And the more prestigious ones, I think. You know, I mean, yes, the publishing industry certainly loves, and the broadcasters love to go to that the other awards ceremony. You know, back in the day when you and I were winning them at left and right, the broadcasting awards were the same night as the restaurant awards at the Marriott Marquis right. in Times Square, which
so
is
you'd
super
have
cool.
Best chef and or best broadcast, and it'd be Martha Stewart. Then it'd be best local food
best
radio,
local right?
And it'd be Steve
it was
and I.
Awesome! It was so much fun.
It was
Al's Fun in the Bun.
Right there, you go.
So now it's separate, and you're right, because all the publishers, broadcasters, writers, most of them are in New York City. They don't want to all schlep here, probably. But I've said this last year to the mayor and to Rich Melman and a couple other guys. I'm like, look, you somehow raised $2.8 million, private money. You know, there's no taxpayer money that goes to this Beard Awards. All private money to bring the awards here. There's quite an infrastructure to do this. How come you can't spend another, I don't know, $500,000 or so and just make them bring all the awards right. here? Because honestly, the people that choose Chicago, the people who promote the city, were falling down in that a lot of these people coming to town are coming on Sunday or Monday and staying for a night or two. Whereas
if you would have done that on a Friday, then it'd be Friday, Saturday, Sunday,
you get
Monday.
A whole weekend.
But the James Beard House and the foundation, everything is in New York. So there is, I can understand maybe pushback on their end behind the scenes saying we don't want to bring everything because, you know, this is our town. This is sort of where
but
we're
the,
at.
No,
right
but,
is Bird here.
But the theme is Chicago. I mean, when they do a Super Bowl in another city, they don't have like a pregame yeah, right. somewhere else. You know, it's right. like you're coming to Chicago this year. The awards are here. Do everything here.
Yeah.
Do it on a Friday. I'm sure they would, you know, with all the money they can raise, they could underwrite the cost of they could probably hire a United jet and put everybody on the same damn plane and bring them all here on a charter flight and charge them like $10, I don't know, for
get
press
the booze race. Flowing so those,
yeah.
so those recipe book authors will
they
get
can,
a little loaded.
I mean, you know, Rahm knows people and yeah. you know, Melman knows people and then Chicago's got some power. It's like, you know, I think I'm going to keep reeling on this.
Right.
Every year, I just, they got to do it here. They got
to
do it.
I like
here.
It. It's all saucy, right. to yeah. use a food word. Steve Dolinsky, the Hungry Hound. Catch him on ABC7 Friday nights at 4, Saturday at 10. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We got outstanding restaurant. Talk about Alinea's in that category. Mm-hmm. Some wine. Best wine.
Well, it's wine program.
Oh, sorry.
Wine program.
And then you've got a couple of design awards for Chicago Interrupt. So we'll talk about that.
All right.
Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Steve Dolinsky from ABC 7. You catch him at 4 o'clock on Fridays, 10 o'clock on Saturdays. We're talking about the James Beards and previewing the James Beard nomination or the awards, which will be on Monday at the Opera House. All right, let's talk about, we talked about Best Chef Great Lakes, which is an all-Chicago category.
Mm-hmm.
But the other big category is Outstanding Restaurant, and this year will be the year for Alinea.
Right. So this category, this is like when they do the Academy Awards, this is definitely like best actor or best film. This is like the last, second to last one. It's usually the best chef is the last award, outstanding chef, and right before that, outstanding restaurant. And I think the requirement is you got to be in business for 10 years,
yes.
which is why Alinea now qualifies.
This is their first year to qualify. It's almost like they're the Hall of Fame, like a Hall of Fame ballot.
It's their first year of eligibility, exactly. Yeah. And so they're up against Frasca Food and Wine in Boulder, Colorado, mm-hmm. which I've been to. Great restaurant, nowhere near the same league as Alinea. Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama. I've heard great things about that. Frank Stitt has been a legendary restaurant. Again, very different. I think more regional and local instead of like, you know, Alinea is up on this sort of different plane,
right?
Momofuku Noodle Bar in New York City. That's confusing, but great restaurant. I mean, the food's fantastic. Never had a bad meal there. But you're sitting on, you know, like hard benches and it's super loud and it's hipster. It's cool. You know, Lower East Side.
But again, nowhere
it's
near
Alinea,
the league of Alinea.
And then the Spotted Pig in New York City, which is fantastic. Like best gastropub I've been to in America.
So
probably.
What do you say? I mean, who, if you were going to pick two, Alinea and another,
Well, I spotted pig or Alinea for sure.
And what do you think? Yeah. Do you think this could be Alinea's
year?
I mean,
Well, here's a funny thing about that, because Alinea has been undergoing this metamorphosis since January. They've been closed since January. And they're reopening. They're having a preview on Monday afternoon. Actually, I'm going to go check it out at lunchtime. They're going to show around the new space. Kevin Peng's got a piece in the New York Times right now. I just saw it online. He wrote about the transformation
It's got a great, brilliant marketing strategy for this restaurant in the way that they're going to open it up right when they win the James Beard Award. I mean, they got it figured out over there.
It would be pretty cool.
They came on the down. Nick Acones came on the download on Tuesday, so that's part of the blitz, too. That's got to be part of the blitz.
He did your show?
Yeah.
Wow, he did our podcast, but I don't know he did your show. That's major.
It's major.
That's really cool.
I think that was part of the strategy. I know when he and Grant and the rest of the crew got together, like, we got to hit Kaufman. We got to get
– Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then the Bayless Dolinsky podcast after that.
But we got to
They're supremely talented. You know, they were bouncing around. They went to Madrid, and then they were in Miami doing pop-ups this winter. Mm-hmm. So they never really rest while they're redoing this place. But the stuff I've read about this, like, they're going to have anchors in the ceiling that will hold up to 100 pounds. So they can hang things like whole Iberian ham legs, or they can hang baskets for people to forage their own food. There's going to be a gallery space on the first floor where chairs can be turned around to kind of make like pods or little entertainment areas. I mean, it's all about emotion, sound, experience, not just the food anymore.
Yeah.
So kudos to those guys.
Well, let's make a transition. I mean, one of the best restaurant design is a category. It's a smaller category on there.
Yeah.
But Chicago's represented in that category. I don't know anything about restaurant design and companies that do this. But I believe there are two groups that are up.
One for over 75 seats, one for under 75 seats. That's the kind of delineation in these categories. But the Cherry Circle Room in the Chicago Athletic Association Hotel on Michigan Avenue. And then Cindy's up on the rooftop, which I think has the best view of the city from any rooftop, because you're looking basically at Millennium Park and the lake.
Right.
And both of those are designed, I heard they spent a ton of money in that building because it kind of had to be retrofitted and it was a dump, and they really sunk some money in it. I think Pritzker's were behind it. Actually, that's what Cindy, I think, is a Pritzker, by the way. So they spent some money on this place, but it's gorgeous. And the Cherry Circle Room is this really cool 60s era wood paneling. I mean, you feel like you're in Mad Men. It's not modern by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just preserved. It's like you walk through like a portal.
Is it considered a prestigious category at the James Beard? Because I would think, the more I think about it, I'm like, that's a big part of restaurants is how what the feeling is when you walk in the door.
Oh, among designers and in the industry, it's a big deal. I mean, could you tell me who won the design award last year? I remember a couple of years ago, David Chang and Paul Kahn, tied for Outstanding Chef. Those are the kind of awards you remember. The design awards, I think most people, but I think within the industry, absolutely, because those are the designers that are then sought after. I think the guy who did Blackbird many years ago was sought after in New York City after he did Blackbird in Chicago. So, that's a good career boost for somebody.
If the big award is Outstanding Chef, we're not seeing any Chicagoans in that category, which is unfortunate.
I'm surprised. Yeah, there's usually a Chicagoan in there. Paul Kahn, of course, has won that before. And there's a lot of veteran chefs in Chicago, and I'm just a little surprised. Also surprised, not best new restaurant. Usually, best new restaurant in the country, there is typically a Chicago one in there. Next has been in there. I thought maybe Momotaro, but that might have missed a cutoff. I know for sure next year you're going to see places like Oriole, which is really outstanding. It just opened up in the West Loop. You'll probably see Royster in there because that's from the next group also.
So there's a cutoff. There's a 2015 cutoff.
These votes came in, several weeks ago. You had to turn all the votes in. So, you can't do it like right now.
Right.
But I'll tell you, this one restaurant that I went to on Best New Restaurants list is called Shaya in New Orleans. I was there about a month ago. Blew me away. Best Israeli food I've ever had outside of Israel.
Really?
I mean, it was really outstanding.
Steve, how many of these restaurants and chefs and all the kind of stuff that we see from around the country have you tasted? Yeah, I mean, would you say like 75%?
No, maybe 60%. Yeah,
really?
More than half. Yeah.
But that's good because that makes it – you have a better understanding of what we have here in town.
I do. Yeah. I mean, it just gives you better, I think, taste experience, taste memories of things that are going on. You kind of get a sense for what is like this Shaya place. I've never experienced anything like it in Chicago. I hope I do one day. But what they're doing in New Orleans, of all places, like you're down the street from Casamento's where they're shucking oysters all day long and making like oyster po' boys. I was so impressed with this place, Shaya. And so he's going to be in town not only for this, but there's going to be an event I think next week at Nico Osteria on Tuesday night I'm going to go to. And then John Besh is there from New Orleans, and this guy's going to be there from Shaya. And it's just, I'm so looking forward to meeting this guy because I've just, you know, rarely does a meal change your life. And this is kind of one of those life-changing, like, holy cow, this was really great.
Wow. But the other category that has Chicago represented would be the best wine program, which once again is Sepia. Sepia seems to be one of these restaurants that is constantly nominated because Andrew, they do great stuff over there, but they just can't.
With get Andrew Zimmerman yeah. as the chef.
love his stuff when he eats.
And that's also, by the way, Emmanuel Noni is the general manager, and he's really the wine yeah. guy there too. Yeah. So that would be part of his program. And that's something certainly feathering the cap for Chicago to have a wine program, outstanding wine program nomination from Chicago. But also service categories, Topolo, Bompo, and North Pond, both in the service category, outstanding service. That's a big deal. I gave Rick a hard time about it last week. I'm like, oh, Susan Lucci, how's it going with the service nomination? It's been like 6 years, I think, he's been nominated
really?
For best service, Topolo. Yeah, but you know, the nice thing is your name every year. Your name is out there with
yeah,
these
right,
other great restaurants, right?
Right, right.
So, but Topolo and North Pond are nominated for service,
the
and also
restaurants, yeah.
outstanding restaurateur. Last year went to Donny Medea from One Off Hospitality. This year, one of the nominees is the Boca Group.
Oh,
so
great.
Kevin Bain
yeah.
and Rob Katz,
right?
They're nominated, and then outstanding pastry chef in the country could be Meg Gallis, who is at the Boca Group also. And she does Cold Storage, Swift & Sons. So there's a couple of you know national awards at stake here for Chicagoans.
For Chicagoans. This weekend, you know, everyone starts to come in, like you said, Sunday. But there's some serious partying that's
serious
going to be
parties.
Going on
oh, yeah.
Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
It really begins Sunday. Because, again, I think a lot of people come in Saturday night. They want to do dinner somewhere. And then Monday all day long beginning. Well, Kendall College, Rick and I are doing this event for there's like five beard nominees from around the country. A lot of culinary students are going to be there in the audience, but we're doing an event at 10 a.m., and then it's like party, 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 party. Bohemian House is having a brunch. There's a luau, a tiki luau barbecue cocktail thing going on at Three Dots and a Dash in their alley. There's River Roast down the street here on LaSalle. They're doing a big thing at 6 in the afternoon. Boca is doing a thing with Shake Shack and Bang
yeah.
Bang Pie.
This is all tomorrow or Sunday.
On Sunday,
right?
yeah. And then Monday, there's a couple lunches for beard nominees and previous winners at Swift & Sons in the afternoon. There's going to be a master class at Il Puccellino, the new lettuce place in River North. They're going to have a master butcher from Italy. There's going to be the Alinea event I told you about. That's mm-hmm. a private event at noon. There's going to be a chef's jacket presentation at the Waldorf at 11 a.m. The president of the Beard Foundation.
What are you going to do? Are you going to try to hit
I
all
mean,
this
my
stuff?
God.
Are you
yeah.
going to try to hit? Is this like, this
well,
is kind of like
I have to
Super Bowl
I'm working.
Week, right?
Well, I'm doing I think I'm going to be live at 5 o'clock on Monday, live from the red carpet right. for ABC. So, yeah, I got to collect a story that day and do something. But and then that night, you know, here's the thing that Chicago has over New York. In New York, and you know this as well as I do, the parties would usually be like a kegger in some chef's basement
right.
On the Lower East Side blasting Beastie Boys. And so yeah, I was like, it's okay. Like
is,
you're celebrating.
Which is pretty awesome.
Which is okay. But like in Chicago last year, Girl and the Goat has a party. Alinea's got a party. Or maybe was it Next? It was Aviary. Sorry. Aviary had a party. Rick Bayless has got, you know, Frontera Topolo. They've got Red Moon Theater dancers and performers walking around, and they're serving amazing food. So there's all these great after parties in Chicago that I think New York sort of doesn't really get or doesn't really want to do. And I know Rick is going to do some kind of a private thing for his new restaurants he's opening
up. Most of these parties, and we've talked about it, are private. But, you know, put a nice jacket on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe put a little medallion around your neck.
Oh, yeah.
No one's going to ask
no one's
anything.
Gonna ask
just
anything.
Walk right up the front door.
I would just say put a black tie on. If
black
you're going to go through the trouble
to
put a black tie on a Monday night at 10:30, 11 o'clock, you know, God bless you.
You're
I mean,
in.
Really, you're in. I mean, come on. You drove in from Clarendon Hills in your black tie.
Just
good
stop
for
off
you.
Stop off at Genghis. Get yourself a one-nighter.
Genghis.
And you're on your way.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's going to be me. That's going to be me.
Steve Dolinsky, the Hungry Hound. You can catch his reports usually Fridays at 4, Saturdays at 10. He'll also be at the red carpet at the James Beard Awards mm-hmm. on Monday night, 5 o'clock on ABC 7. Thanks for being here. Thanks for breaking it down for us. And have a safe and crazy, crazy weekend.
I will. Fingers crossed, Justin. Thanks.
is the download here on WGN Radio. I am Justin Kaufman. Thanks for joining us. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it's The Frying Pan, where local innovator and inventor Steve Gadlin comes on from Shark Tank fame, and he gives us his latest invention, and we workshop it, and we decide if it's good or bad. Not a great track record, I'm going to be honest with you, but Steve has promised that he's been working on it, and I think he's got a killer idea. He's very excited about it tonight. So 312-981-7200, that's coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, the Steps of Faith Foundation is presenting a night of comedy tomorrow night called Laughs for Limbs Chicago. It's a fundraiser for the foundation, which provides prosthetic care for amputees. Over 185,000 new amputations happen every year in this country. Billy Brimblecum Jr. is the executive director of Steps of Faith. He knows firsthand the physical and emotional pain of losing a limb. He lost his left leg back in 2005 to cancer. He joins me now. Billy, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So excited to be in Chicago. I mean, you live in Nashville, so you just flew in, and thank you for making it here. I was convinced you weren't going to make it when you said, my flight lands at 7:30. I was like, I ain't going
to
make it.
I was just happy to know the show was so late, and my hotel is like around the corner, so it's great.
So talk about, we'll talk about the show a little bit, and Kay Cannon is the MC, a longtime Chicago improviser. We know her well. She's been on the show. But for Steps of Faith, how important is it for you guys to get out and be able to put these fundraisers on in different towns?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I mean, a nonprofit is a business, and just like any business, you got to make money. And so with a charity, you've got to be raising money. And you know, the reason we're here is, like you said, Kay is on our board, and she's an old friend of mine. And she said, "Hey, how about the next one? Let's do it in Chicago." So it's like, that's a great idea. So you know, when she Kay had actually participated in a fundraiser that some friends put on for me when I needed to raise a ridiculous amount of money many, many years ago to get a prosthetic leg that my insurance wasn't fully covering. And it was comedy and music and at a rock club, and it was beautiful, and we raised a ton of money. It was awesome. So when she joined the board, she said, "We're going to do what we know. We're going to do fundraisers that with comedy and rock and roll, and it's going to be great." And so, you know, here we are a couple years later, and we've done them in L.A. and we've done them in Kansas City, and here we are in Chicago.
Well, it's a great way to raise money. I mean, it's better than sort of a stuffy kind of black tie approach to it. But let's talk about the steps of faith. You know, it provides prosthetic care, and it's important because really what you're doing is giving people, you know, amputees an opportunity to walk again. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm lucky that I even know we had to raise a lot of money. You know, I have health insurance, and since then my health insurance has covered the what I have needed as far as a prosthetic leg. Without that, I would not have been able to easily get on an airplane and get here and walk up the steps from lower Michigan Avenue up to here. You know? And so, you know, and that's like cool things. I'm coming here, I'm talking on the radio. That's great. But with that, you know, if you've lost a limb and you can have a prosthetic leg and that will allow you to walk, but you are not allowed to have it because of some financial reason, that's ridiculous.
Right.
Not everybody that loses a limb can then walk for whatever physical reason, you know. But if money's the thing in the way, that's injustice. And a lot of times people are stuck in a catch-22 where it's like, well, I can't afford the $5,000 to $10,000 to get the basic thing I need until I get back to work, but I can't get back to work until I'm able to get the prosthesis.
Right, right.
So it's a catch-22, and what we do is we come in and we stop that catch-22.
I was going to say, it seems like it's a no-brainer for insurance companies or for medical facilities to offer that at low cost, because it really does. I mean, it's a necessity in some ways for people, but it is an expensive procedure to fit a prosthetic limb. I mean, it just seems like one of those things that seems to be overlooked.
Well, absolutely. I mean, even with 500 amputations in America every day, you know, I think people seem to think it's, you know, there was this whole thing about going around this hashtag prosthetics are not a luxury, because there was this thing going through where Medicaid was trying to make it even less than what the coverage currently is. It's a whole mess and it's totally overlooked. And like I just, you know, was looking into this new insurance policy, like, oh yeah, well, we don't cover that. And I said, well, why not? Why not?
Yeah, right.
You know, it should be a thing. It should be a thing where, along with your amputation, that's like part of the coverage that you get, no matter what. It's like, okay, well, you're going to need this, you know, but it's not. Yeah, it's definitely overlooked and it's ridiculous and terrible.
Well, let's talk about your story. Back in 2005, you had Ewing sarcoma, which is a form of cancer, and you had to lose your left leg. So tell us about your story.
Yeah, I was 28. I had had pain in my left leg for several years after a car accident. We thought it was some sort of undiagnosed trauma related to that. My back was really messed up in the car accident. Pain was getting worse. Finally got it checked out. It wasn't cancer for that long, but cancer had developed there. And, it was about a year long process of me going through really intense chemotherapy. And then kind of in the middle of that, I knew there would be some extreme surgery. Yeah. And then, the only reason I would lose my leg would be to save my life, which is what I was told at the beginning. And, with a sarcoma, you have to remove it and everything that it touches.
Right.
And it was a big old ball of cancer in my leg. And, so they needed to take it, but I felt like I kind of saw it coming and, so it obviously changed my life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, right.
But the good news is I lived to tell the tale, got the girl and limped off into the sunset.
Well, for you, I mean, the emotional experience is something that, was as powerful for you as the physical. I mean, obviously losing a limb and losing a part of a leg to save your life is not just something that is physical. There's a mental aspect that goes to that.
Huge, huge. You know, when you're going through hard times, you want to be able to talk to somebody that can relate to you, even if like your transmission goes out in your car, like, oh my gosh, I need someone that can help me that knows what I'm going through, you know? So when something like that happens, it's hugely important to be able to have that kind of connection. So two things to that peer support piece is huge. And the guy who the cancer center hooked me up with way back then that had gone through what I went through, but was like on the other side of it. He was like a year out. It was a great ally to me, Brendan Allen. Was his name. He lives in Lawrence, Kansas. And long story short, he's now on our board and will be there tomorrow night. And, you know, he's a lifelong friend. I mean, I'll be friends with that guy forever. And we share that experience together. But yeah, there's also the emotional piece of receiving the prosthesis, and this is what we're able to do for people. It's not like, well, now you can go back to work and walk, and it's like, okay, great. There's a practical thing, and on paper, that's wonderful. Yes, it is, but it also is an emotional and mental thing too. Where for me, I just, you know, I would just feel different if I had to come in here on crutches without my prosthesis on. I don't hide it. I wear shorts all the time. You know, I work for a charity that gets these for other people. It's part of, you know, but it's that emotional piece of knowing like I can come here and walk into this place and I'm fine, you know.
Billy Brimblecombe Jr. is the executive director of Steps of Faith. The show is tomorrow night at IO over on Kingsbury, right by that great Whole Foods. It starts at 6 o'clock in Lincoln Park. The MC will be Kay Cannon. Cannon, of course, of 30 Rock fame and Pitch Perfect. We'll continue our conversation with Billy when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The Steps of Faith Foundation is presenting a night of comedy called Last for Limbs Chicago. It's going to be at IO tomorrow night, 6 o'clock. It's going to be emceed by Kay Cannon, a former Chicago improviser who now lives in Los Angeles. She's a former writer for 30 Rock. She penned and produced the Pitch Perfect movies, which I just saw Pitch Perfect 2 on cable. It was the first time I saw it. And we haven't talked to her since she came on right before promoting that movie. So hopefully she'll join us tonight. But in studio with me right now, Billy Brimblecombe Jr. He's the executive director of Steps of Faith. And we're talking about the organization, which really, I mean, provides prosthetic care for amputees. And when we talk about care, part of it
is the money, raising the money so they can, there's prosthesis involved. But the other part is the emotional part of running sort of a smaller sort of peer network to get people through the fact that they're, you know, they've lost a limb and they need to move on and work with the prosthetics that are given to them.
Absolutely.
Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Yes. Good. Yes. Well put. Yeah. Yeah. You know, the financial piece is the biggest piece and also kind of step one. You know, what we do is, you know, the short of it is, yeah, we get prosthetics for people that can't afford them. But, you know, what that means is we raise money to pay for prosthetic devices when for people that don't have insurance or are underinsured, mm-hmm. Or they have some sort of, you know, weird policy, that kind of thing. So, but the peer support piece, like I said, is huge. I mean, that was the day I found I didn't want to have anything to do with that guy, Brendan Allen. Once I knew, oh, you have all the same cancers. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. And he lost his leg. He's doing great. I was so deathly afraid of that happening to me that I didn't want to talk to him.
This is before
I got the news, right. You know? And so, cause like I said, it was about a year long process and the surgery was in the middle of it. And then, but the day I found out, he was among the first people I called. And so, that piece is huge, you know?
And what did he say to you? I mean, what do you say to people who call up and who may be a little bit leery about the process or don't want to share or are scared about what's going to happen? What do you provide? What do you offer when you talk to somebody on the phone?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I love that part of it. And, as we're growing, I have less and less time to be able to spend. That's why we're working on developing this out, to be able to recommend people to programs that only do that. But that's actually how this whole job came about for me, is because my prosthetist, the guy that helps me, I was in an appointment and he said, hey, will you talk to this guy that just lost his leg to cancer on your way out? And, you know, I've had a few conversations a year. Every year like that, you know, somebody I went to high school with reaches out to me on Facebook and their cousin's husband is losing his, you know, several degrees removed. Like, I know a guy. And I was always thankful to be able to have those conversations because it's like you speak a different language at that point.
Right.
You know, being able to, like I said, being able to talk to somebody that can really relate, not like I feel for you, but like I know what you're going through. I always just tell people, you know, I just answer their questions, but just tell them like it does get better. It does get better. You know, I mean, like I say, I got the girl and limped off into the sunset. I mean, you know, when I met my wife, I was going through chemotherapy. I had lost my leg. I was on crutches. I had no hair, gray skin, super skinny, no leg. And she fell in love with me like that, you know? So in particular, if it's younger people or single people or that kind of thing, like, you know, it gets better. I mean, with anybody, I mean, it gets better. And I just try to be encouraging and let them know that like, this is, you know, losing your limb is not losing your life. And as long as you're alive, live, you know? And, so yeah, I'm just really lucky, you know, really lucky.
I always think of, you know, when I think of amputations, obviously veterans come to mind, war injuries, you know, that's sort of what's the prevailing images that are on television or pop culture, anything about what we know about amputees or anyone who's lost a limb. But cancer plays a big role in this, and disease and things of that nature. That I mean, it happens, like you said, 500 times a day.
Yeah,
and the number I threw out at the top is like 185,000. A year. I mean, it's millions.
Yeah, right. Yeah, over 2 million in just in America. I mean, other countries as a whole. Oh, goodness. India. Oh, my gosh. So, I mean, I get asked all the time, you know, being a youngish person, they just assume that I've lost my leg in combat. And the answers are, when I tell them it's cancer, it's like never the answer anyone expects. And so it's always like, oh, or, oh, I'm so sorry. Or, oh, well that's hard too. You know, no one knows how to react. So I'm usually just consoling people, just always, it's okay. You know? Yeah, it's funny, but yeah, the higher stat is vascular disease. You know, I mean, there's is some sort of vascular disease, diabetes, that kind of thing.
Right.
Cancers, trauma, motorcycle accidents. We have another amputee on our board who lost his leg in a terrible motorcycle accident. And so there's a lot of that. But yeah, you know, and the fortunately we have not up to this point have not, I will use these words carefully, thankfully needed to help any veterans, just because
they're
usually taken care of.
They're taken care of by the VA.
Yeah. At least initially, you right. know, so
after the fact, that's what the country's arguing about. What happens 10 yeah. years down the line. Yeah. 10 right. years down the line. Right.
Right. Right. So I hope that we will never need to help a vet.
Right.
And we haven't yet, thankfully. So.
So, you know, tomorrow night's going to be the show, and Kay's going to be the MC, and there's going to be a lot of great music and comedy. For you, I mean, you know, when you're at these things and you're raising money and you're moving and shaking, I mean, because you've gone through it, because, you know, you've, like you said, you've limped, you got the girl limped off in the sunset, which yeah. is a great line. What's your feeling when you see people come out to support this, or, you know, you know that this money's going to help somebody else? I mean, are you more emotional about it because you've gone through it yourself?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. I feel that this, at least for now in my life, you know, I chased a career in music, forever. And, that was beautiful and heartbreaking all at the same time. And I was always the guy that was the most fired up of any group I was in about like making it happen, you know? And, I'm more fired up about this, you know, helping people in a real way and putting people's dollars to work, and it pays off with every step. So yeah, I love it. I love it. If there's a fundraiser for us, I want to be there. And usually I am, just because, you know, I want to be able to tell people how it is, you know?
Right.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. I love it.
Billy Brimblecum Jr. is the executive director of Steps of Faith, which is a foundation that provides prosthetic care for amputees. And like I said, over 185,000 new amputations happen every year in this country. The fundraiser, Laughs for Limbs Chicago, is tomorrow night at the I.O. on Kingsbury in Lincoln Park. Starts at 6 p.m. It's going to feature comedy and music from some of Chicago's best, and the show will be emceed by Kay Cannon. Cannon is a former Chicagoan who now lives in LA. She was a writer on 30 Rock, Pitch Perfect. Billy, great to meet you.
Thank you
congrats
so much.
on the fundraiser, and good luck tomorrow. And I hope you raise a ton of money and all, and the organization is able to help a lot of people.
Stepsoffaithfoundation.org. You can't come, you can donate right there. Thank you so much.
I wanna hit you with a frying pan.
Yes, we know what that frying pan sound means. Time for the frying pan. It's actually time to put Shark Tank Steve Gadlin into the frying pan. Gadlin is the brains behind the successful local business I Want to Draw a Cat for You.com. He presented his business idea on the television program Shark Tank, and he snagged Mark Cuban as a principal investor. So now Steve has to go back to Cuban with his new ideas. And before he goes into that pressure cooker, he comes to WGN Radio to jump into the frying pan. He's given us his exclusive business ideas so we can poke holes into it and give Steve the confidence to pitch it to Cuban himself. Steve Gadlin, welcome back to the frying pan.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Great to see you. Great to see you.
It's good to see you. It's good to be here.
So, okay, so let's get, you know, it's been a couple weeks. We had some Blackhawks games. The Blackhawks are done with their season. They'll be back in the fall, so that means we have some time for the frying pan. Are you excited for the sort of wide open space to be able to pitch your ideas?
Definitely. You know, and I think Blackhawk fans need to remember they didn't win the playoffs, but they tried their hardest.
That's great. That's
yeah. It's something
not unlike you.
With. No, that's what
and,
I do every
what
week.
What you do here at the frying pan. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 312-981-7200. That's the phone number. 312-981-7200. If you're a new listener to this segment, Steve's going to give us his idea here, and then we're going to ask you if you like it, if you don't, if you have suggestions, questions, and some criticism and critique, so Steve can get a better idea of what people think in the marketplace about his invention. All right, Steve, are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Yeah. All right, so let's hear this week's frying pan.
So with the way the seasons are changing, I know those of us in Chicago can feel that spring is in the air.
Right.
And a lot of people are going back out to the backyard or the front yard to tend to their gardens.
Okay, right? Gardening.
They notice that because of the winter, there are now dirt patches in the ground. Some of the grass has faded away. Maybe a lot of the gardening areas are looking dead and bad, and they want things to do to fix them. But not all of us have the time to plant a healthy garden.
Right, right. Absolutely. I know that.
So what I've invented is something called rainbow dirt. So this is multicolored dirt. We sell dirt in all different colors. We recommend it instead of grass, instead of flowers. You just lay this dirt down in different colors and create beautiful, engaging, colorful landscapes instead of the time-consuming, hard-to-tend-to gardens or lawns, things like that. It's you use rainbow dirt, and your yard is done. You're okay. Done. It's very low maintenance, and you can earn yourself plenty of free time this summer and this spring.
Let me write this down. Rainbow dirt. Dirt.
So we sell it in 7 different colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. And you lay out those colors, and you can make designs, you can mix the colors, you can do whatever you want. But the gist is, instead of flowers, you let the dirt do the talking, right? And dirt's very easy to tend to. You don't need to water it. You don't need to, it doesn't even need sunshine.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right, I've got questions.
Okay.
Rainbow dirt is the idea this week on the frying pan. 312-981-7200. I'm going to refrain from my questions because I always like to put the listeners first. You can text or you can call with your thoughts, yay or nay, questions, concerns, criticisms, or I would even throw in their championing.
Yeah, and I think we'll see a lot of that because I think in America today, something that people ask themselves daily is, hey, who has time to tend to the garden?
Right.
You know, and this is a way of saying, no garden, we don't need you, we have rainbow dirt. It's an evolution of the garden. It's an evolution of the ground. It's an evolution, literally, of the earth.
Wow. Okay, well, we'll see what people have to say. We'll take a quick break. 312-981-7200. Do you like rainbow dirt? It's the frying pan. We'll be right back. I'm gonna hit you with a frying pan. I'm gonna beat you till you turn to sand. I'm gonna tell the world that you're my man and just how much I love you. It's the download here, and it's Friday night at 10 o'clock, so you know that's time for the frying pan. Steve Gadlin is in studio. He's the man behind IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. He brought his business idea to Shark Tank. He won. He now has a development deal with Mark Cuban to bring new ideas to Cuban, and before he does that, he brings us here to the download so we can workshop it. He lets the WGN radio audience give him suggestions, and we got a lot. The lines are jammed up. We got some texts. Once again, elevator pitch for rainbow dirt.
So we sell different colored dirts that you can spread in your garden instead of planting grass and instead of planting flowers. Much lower maintenance, and we sell them in buckets, 1 gallon buckets, $75 a bucket, and you use this instead of seeds. It adds color and personality to your garden without ever having to water it, without having to worry about sunshine. It's perfect for the person on the go.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let's go to the line and get some feedback. Let's start with Emily. Emily, you're on the frying pan. Yay or nay to rainbow dirt. Uh-oh.
I hope you're kidding. Mark Cuban must be an idiot. That is the stupidest idea I have ever heard of.
I don't know if Mark Cuban's heard it yet. Steve's just workshopping it here before he gives it to Mark Cuban, but you don't like the idea.
Oh, my God. It's gross. It's ridiculous.
Why?
You know, well, look, you want the green grass, you want flowers, you want beauty, and you don't want to, it's like taking some chalk and writing on the sidewalk.
Right.
No, I just think it's totally insane.
Well, that's just your opinion.
Yes, it is.
All right. Thank you, Emily. Thank you. We appreciate that. Thanks for calling in. All right. There we go.
She's biased. You know, I think she's biased from the start. I think she'd be a hard person to win over. But fortunately, we're targeting the millennial audience. That's an audience that doesn't have time for planting a garden, watering their lawn. They've got social media to engage with.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's really the group we're looking for here.
All right. Let's keep going. Let's go to Glenn. Glenn, you're on with the frying pan. Yay or nay to rainbow dirt?
I think it's a yay. I like the idea.
Thanks, Glenn.
Yeah. As far as, I'll go even one step farther. I don't even know why you need Mark Cuban anymore. You know, you've come up with so many good ideas. But one thing, though, is could it be glow in the dark so you can appreciate it at night?
That's actually something I had thought of, Glenn. That's an idea that I had earlier. We are going to make glow in the dark ones so that it does glow at night.
That's a great idea.
Well,
just
I'm very
because,
smart. Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, like, if you think about what people do to their lawns and houses in the wintertime with Christmas lights, this could be the summer version of that.
Yeah, and it is. It is a summer version of Christmas lights. It's one of the slogans that I already had trademarked and patented, but it is definitely something I had thought of. And, you know, the glowing nature, there are a lot of minerals that we work into the dirt that are naturally glowing. So, yeah.
Okay, well, let's keep going with the calls. Sure. Let's go to Bill. Bill, yay or nay on rainbow dirt?
Yay!
All right.
Thank you. I think it would go over really good with the gay community myself.
How so?
And, well, it's the rainbow. I mean, they like rainbows. I'm not gay, but there's nothing wrong with being gay. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But I think if he'd throw like a rainbow dirt hole in there, that everybody would be eating it up. Yeah. That's just my opinion.
I don't follow you. We're all really aiming toward the millennial audience.
Thanks, Bill. That was great.
Audience, but, no, I think that's I'm glad to get a yay. That's fantastic.
Yeah, you're doing pretty well here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's two yays in a row. Let's go to John. John, yay or nay on the rainbow dirt?
Yay.
Yay.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
This is one of Steve's better ideas.
I appreciate that, John.
Why do you say that, John?
Because he has to come out with a line of colored straitjackets to match the colored dirt.
All right. There.
Why? I don't understand the connection there.
Well, you need some fashion clothes to spread the dirt.
You know, one of the other inventions that I had earlier called the three shirt would actually, we could sell different colored versions of the three shirt to go along with this too.
Now, yeah, that's
great
too.
A t-shirt with three sleeve holes so you can wear it in six different configurations.
I love it.
All right. Thanks, John. Thank you for that. Thanks for calling in. So you're getting a lot of yays here.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it.
708 says a Japanese garden in color. I like the idea.
Yeah.
But I still need a place for plants.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what they're saying is like, you want the dirt to replace plants?
No, the dirt is, it replaces the soil. But one of the things about the color dirt is we use a lot of chemicals to achieve the bright, vibrant colors.
Mm-hmm.
I would not recommend planting anything in the dirt, especially anything that you might later eat. So no vegetables, flowers probably will not survive for long.
Right.
Due to the chemicals that are in the dirt.
But so 309 says, how would you grow tomatoes, peppers, et cetera? You're saying don't.
Don't. No, we say, you know what? You don't need to grow peppers and tomatoes, et cetera. You get those at the grocery store. We're talking to a millennial audience who doesn't have time to grow their own vegetables, grow their own fruits. This is an audience that our customer base, really, a movement that doesn't want to have to grow things, you know? So this keeps their yard pretty in absence of any of the hard work it takes to grow a garden.
This is the text 217 that really represents a lot of text. There's probably about five different of this iteration.
Mm-hmm.
Won't the dirt just wash away with the rain?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what I like to say when people bring up rain is, who am I, God? Okay, because I don't control the weather. And really, if you think about it, if you're planting flowers and fruits and vegetables, think of the damage rain does to those, right? That's nothing I can control. We are all victims to the whims of a lady I call Mother Nature. And there's really nothing we can do to prevent the rain. So, you know, we recommend if it rains, of course, all the color will wash out. It really, the color doesn't wash out, but all the colors will mix together. And when all colors mix together, you get brown. So you'll get a nice even brown. And if you want to add more color to it, you buy more buckets of rainbow dirt.
There you go. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Jim. Jim, you're on the frying pan. Yay or nay on rainbow dirt?
I'm going to say nay, but I'll give a little yay to it, because if you don't have plants and flowers and whatnot, you don't have bugs and mosquitoes. But conversely, there's no dimension to it. It's flat. So to me, there would be like a parking lot, and although it would be aesthetically pleasing with the different colors, then it would be kind of boring because it's flat, in my humble opinion.
Well, Jim,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't remember hearing any art critic say, you know, the Mona Lisa's okay, but it's flat. Okay, you know, I think people are used to two-dimensional art. I think, in fact, a garden, a three-dimensional garden is probably very disconcerting until you get used to it. So I'm not too worried about
it. It's kind of like when you have that three-dimensional chalk art on the sidewalk and you think like maybe it's a stairwell and you're like, whoa, but then you realize it's just chalk art.
Yeah, this is different but the same.
Right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We'll take a break. Go to the news with Rob. Keep them coming. 312-981-7200. Let's queue up some more. Some questions, comments, concerns, criticisms, and I would say some confidence boosters. I'm trying to think of a.
I'm getting a lot of yays.
You're getting a lot of yays tonight. 312-981.
Rob Martier is about to give a big yay.
Martier loves him. All right, we'll take a break and then we'll get Rob in the news. Stay with us. I'm gonna hit you with a frying pan. I'm gonna beat you to your turn to sand. I'm gonna tell the world that you're my man and just how much I love you. There we go. Welcome back to The Download. It's Friday night, 10 o'clock hours. Always The Frying Pan, where we bring Steve Gadlin in studio with his newest invention and innovation. In this case, it is, what do we got there? You hear that? What?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's interesting. Rob will shut that off. That's interesting. I never heard that before. All right, so Steve Gadlin is in studio with me. He's the local inventor and innovator. He did iwanttodrawcatforyou.com. He won on Shark Tank. As part of that, he got the development deal with Mark Cuban. Mm-hmm. Before he brings any new ideas to Mark Cuban, he brings them here to Download Nation, and we critique. And so far tonight, you're getting a lot of yays for the idea, Rainbow Dirt.
That's right. Rainbow Dirt is it's dirt, but we color it different colors, so you can use that instead of plants or, you know, high-maintenance grass, high-maintenance lawns, high-maintenance flowers and trees. You spread different color rainbow dirts, and, you're done. You're done for the season.
And this would be sort of to replace gardening and plants
exactly.
and lawns. And
exactly. Because today's millennial doesn't have time to water a plant or to grow their own food. You know, you want something quick and easy that you can set it and forget it.
All right. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Diane. Diane, yay or nay on rainbow dirt?
I have questions first.
Okay, great.
First question. You're talking about rainbow dirt, not rainbow soil, correct? So you're talking about inorganic and mineral-based substrate,
well,
not a soil.
You know, I'd say dirt is probably a misnomer. It's more of a marketing term.
Okay.
What we found through the science that we're using in order to get the color to stick, the best material is actually comprised of a combination of squirrel and raccoon dung. So it is organic material, and that helps the dye stick to it, if that answers your question.
Yes. And then the pigment, the dye is chemical-based, which, I mean, it isn't in a latex. It's in... Yeah, I'm curious as to what type of chemicals you're expecting to hold.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing. We haven't fully tested it, but what we're trying to do is by feeding the squirrels and raccoons very specific foods, we hope to naturally color the dung so that we can achieve all different colors of the rainbow.
So you would do it organically?
Organically. Now, some of those colors have been easier to achieve than others. We can get blue real easily. We can get red real easily. Something like yellow, we have to do a lot of post-processing with very toxic chemicals. So what we say to people who use the yellow is not to put it near any water pipeline, not to put it near any area where children may be playing.
Right. And then what is the difference between rainbow dirt and just using a colored mulch? You can achieve the same goals with number
mulch,
of different
right, with
mulch,
the colored mulch.
Whether it's yeah. a stone
I don't know if
or
you've
a
ever,
colored.
I don't know if you've ever taken a whiff of mulch, Diane, but I'm pretty sure mulch is short term for horse poop. And that's just a mess.
Mulch is either shredded hardwood. It can
no,
be
No, I think I'm
going
to have to agree to disagree with you on this one. I'm pretty sure from a scene that I saw in Back to the Future that mulch is actually horse dung.
I can promise you as a master gardener, it is not.
Well, I can promise you as a master inventor that it is.
Not if a lot of people can go out and purchase mulches of different colors now mm-hmm. that are organic and safe for the soil. They'll actually protect the soil.
They're purchasing horse dung when they do that.
No.
Yes.
Compost and horse manure is a different product.
Now, compost is worms.
Worm compost is one type of compost. There are seven others. But what I'm saying is I'm not certain. You're targeting the millennial audience, correct?
Yes, right. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And you identified the price point as $75 per gallon for
correct.
This colored dirt.
Yes.
Well, if I was a millennial and I had a home, mm-hmm. for $75 a week, I could have someone to come in and cut my grass and take care of my yard.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you're right. Diane, that's a good point.
Growing plants
I disagree.
That support the environment and that I could eat.
I would say
right.
so most millennials.
Where did the $75 price point come from?
Well, because right. a lot of millennials are really excited about these tiny homes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we're on the same page.
Which allows them to hire people to care for their environment. If they're not interested in learning to do it for themselves.
Well,
but a lot
again,
of the millennials who come to our programs mm-hmm. are interested in growing their own food
I see.
And
so
creating
this is about a program. What I'm,
landscape.
Yeah, so you are what I see as someone politicking here on air for their program when I'm trying to produce a product as an entrepreneur.
I don't need to politic for a program. I'm simply saying I don't understand the strategy of going mm-hmm. after a millennial population.
Right. Well,
that actually has choices, and to say that they want to create muddy brown, you know, you said that Mother Nature is going to wash this through. What do you expect the length of your product lasting? You said it's not going to last an entire season
right.
if it's rainy. So
all
how
right.
often would you expect people to re-up or reapply this rainbow dirt.
Right. Well, I'm
okay.
selling this
Diane,
to investors.
I want to thank you for that. Let's move on. But the question is, how often do you have to apply? You know, because you didn't mention rain,
yeah.
but let's say it doesn't rain. How often do you have to apply?
Well, I'll say this.
Rainbow
again,
dirt.
I'm not on air to sell this to consumers. I'm on air to sell this to investors, right? So the idea is you need to apply it a whole lot, right? You'll need to probably weekly purchase new buckets to cover your entire garden.
Mm-hmm.
Not even rain, but actually sunlight starts decomposing the colorization pretty rapidly because we're talking about organic material.
Which I guess from a marketing standpoint would mean that that's good for the company because if somebody did want rainbow dirt, they would have to invest heavily into it.
Exactly. I but see. We don't tell them that in the commercials, of course.
Right. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's keep going with the phones. I got a ton of texts, too, and I'm going to get to them coming up here. Let's go to Janine. Janine, yay or nay on rainbow dirt?
I'd have to go on nay because your inventor doesn't even know what mulch is. And mulch is shredded tree bark, and you can color that.
Well, that's your opinion.
Like the other lady said.
Mulch is actually
all right, thank you very much for that, Janine.
Horse dung.
Seems like a lot of people are calling up and dismissing, or not dismissing, but arguing back, saying you may be wrong.
I think they're forgetting that I'm an entrepreneur.
Right. Okay, well.
And I don't think there's any such thing as a master gardener, as that earlier lady claimed to be. I don't know. Who awards that certificate? The Jolly Green Giant? You know, I don't know where that goes from.
All right, 312-981-7200. Let me get through some of these texts. There's some great questions in here.
Okay.
Let me get through here. Let me see. Might be good. This is good. 773 says they live to a very public space, mm-hmm. right? Maybe this would be good for public spaces. And instead of a garden or a lawn, that this could be something that the cities and municipalities could use to spruce up empty lots.
Yeah. I call that a yay. I agree. I think it would be a great idea for not only homeowners and millennials, but for municipalities as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Public areas.
All right. Okay. I want to save some of these for the last segment. Okay, so yeah, it okay. Is it going to damage water quality when the rain seeps through it?
I don't understand that question. I guess who drinks rainwater?
Well, I think that rain there's you know, a lot of times rainwater goes into the ground and it's recycled into the earth, that kind of thing.
Not familiar with that cycle, so I'm not sure. I would say again, we recommend that people do not use rainbow dirt near any underground pipes that carry water that will eventually be consumed by humans. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's, you know, in terms of whether nature water gets hurt by it, I'm not sure.
773 asks, why not natural sand and dirt from different parts of the world? Because it comes in many different colors.
Yeah, but boring colors. You know, we're talking about vibrant fluorescence, right? This mm-hmm. is something that's really going to punch. I'd say natural dirt is boring in its color. But, you know, by manipulating organic dung mm-hmm. of raccoons and squirrels, we can create some really almost glowing fluorescent colors. That
all right, let's really keep going. Let's go to Rick. Rick, yay or nay on rainbow dirt?
Nay. Okay. Are you aware that raccoon scat is highly toxic?
I'm not sure what scat is.
It's scat dung. Is dung.
Feces, droppings, mm-hmm. what comes out of its anal port.
Okay.
Well, am I aware of that? Is that the question?
Yeah. Listen, if raccoons get into someone's house and they leave their droppings around,
yeah,
you have to get someone in chem suits to remove it.
Why?
Because it's toxic.
Well, we're not asking.
You know, are you aware of what raccoons eat?
No.
Did you even research this?
Well, look, sir, we're not asking people to eat rainbow dirt.
No, you're not getting it. You can't handle it with your bare hands.
No.
You wear
gloves or...
You can't even be around. If you breathe it, you can get sick from it.
Well, now I'm not sure about that, sir. I think, again, we'll have to agree to disagree.
Right.
I can guarantee you that you're going to poison the consumer with it.
Okay, we'll cross raccoon dung off of the ingredients. We'll just use the squirrel stuff. Jeez.
you're a maniac.
He is a maniac. All right. Thank you very much, Rick. And, Rick, that was colorful, I will say.
I don't like that guy.
No, Rick, you're getting a lot of pushback tonight. There's some very articulate.
I like the way that I started where it was yay, yay, yay.
But, you know, you got to give it up for the articulate, smart consumers who are pushing back. I mean, it's going to make your product better.
When I hear from one, I'll give it up.
All right, all right.
But I think Rick was just biased against the idea because he didn't think of it first.
All right. 312-981-7200. We'll take our last break. When we come back, some of the more colorful comments from the texts, we'll read them to Steve and
like
see how he
reacts.
Rainbow
dirt is colorful.
There so, you go. Yeah. See how I played with that.
Yeah, that's good. I wanna hit you with a frying pan. I wanna beat you till you turn to sand. I wanna tell the world that you're my man and just how much I love you. How much I love you.
It's the frying pan here on Download and WGN Radio. Let's get to some of the texts and tweets that came in during the segment, some more colorful stuff that that I think you need to read or at least hear, Steve.
Okay.
This is the part that's never fun for me, but we've learned to love it.
Sure.
773 says, I lost it. Here it is. This is the worst idea since caramel flavored mulch.
Okay.
That's funny.
Well, that wasn't mine.
Yeah. No, that wasn't. 7217 says, a master gardener is an actual thing. It's a program offered at the University of Illinois. Colored dirt.
That's not even an accredited university.
The idea is fun, but poorly thought through.
Okay.
You are way too cocky. This is not my words. You're way too cocky, mm-hmm. and I'm turning you off.
Okay.
You had me at the – this is 414 – that okay. says, you had me at the beginning of the program giving you a thumbs up for this invention. Now I'm sorry to say that you're coming off as the biggest smartass on the face of the earth. Now my question would be, why can't you use food coloring as a natural color? Why are you getting depressed? That's how it ended.
Well, I'd say, frankly, our scientists have a lot more fun engineering with organic material. So food coloring to us is not exciting. You don't get vibrant colors. But by force feeding raccoons and squirrels radioactive material, you are able to get a glowing fluorescent dung with a consistency of soil.
You know, a lot of people at the beginning of this conversation really liked the idea of the rainbow dirt. It kind of devolved, but really it kind of took a wrong turn when you started interacting with the Master Gardener. This is where the texts come in. 773, how dare you insult the Master Gardener?
Okay.
This guy on air is a jerk. He's done no research. He's a fraud.
Well, I'd say anyone calling themselves a Master Gardener is a fraud, because how do you become a Master Gardener? How hard is it?
Okay.
You know, you
well,
put
847 says Master
them.
Gardener is awarded by Botanic Garden of Chicago after many strenuous classes.
Okay, well, how many...
And it's also at the Illinois Extension, the University of Illinois, and someone also sent in a text of the Wikipedia of what a Master Gardener is.
Okay, well, I can go start a Wikipedia today.
All right, well,
of what a master,
I think the point being is that there
something
are,
else is.
That yeah. argument that there is no such thing and people are making up a Master Gardener may be false and why people are getting upset.
Okay.
This guy, 224, is the biggest a-hole.
Okay.
And a moron.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, I got to get past this long Wikipedia thing.
Okay.
You, sir, are wrong. I work at Home Depot, and I know what mulch is.
Well, no, that, sir, is wrong. Mulch, and if you Google it or look it up in the dictionary, you will see it is unequivocally horse dung. Stinky, smelly horse dung. That's what mulch is.
Yeah, that's they're arguing that that's not what mulch is.
Well,
that's
I'm
manure.
Arguing,
I'm getting
I'm
a lot
arguing,
of manure.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to apologize to the listeners. I got the two words mixed up.
Come on, man.
I was thinking of manure when people were saying mulch, so my mistake.
309 says, worst debater ever. Is this guy for real?
I'm actually a master debater.
There you go.
Yeah.
Never have this idiot on again. Don't be so rude. Mm-hmm. You came in way too expensive. It's your fault.
Mm-hmm.
There's some. I'm just getting through the ones with swear words. We can't use those.
Understood.
Let's see. Squirrel dung. Mm-hmm. Your guest is a smart ass.
Okay. But part of that is smart.
Yeah. Well,
your guest is smart.
So you're,
maybe
you're full of
your
BS.
Your guest is smart, comma, yeah. The other word.
No.
Okay.
There's some really good ones here. I'm just trying to get. There's a lot of texts, man. This is probably the most we've ever had. And they're mostly mad with you arguing with the Master Gardener.
Well, let me tell you this. I go to the Botanic Garden probably weekly.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, and I enjoy the Botanic Garden, and I appreciate that there are people that put seeds in the ground and sprinkle water on them a couple times a day so that I can enjoy the Botanic Garden. So
708
if they
says,
want to be called Master Gardener, that's fine.
Okay.
I tip my hat to you, Master Gardener.
You're digging a hole.
Okay.
708 says, keep drawing cats.
Okay.
815 says, I'm burning my money, videotaping it, and putting it on YouTube would be more useful than buying rainbow-colored dirt.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
Not
really, but if they want to, if they're resorting to hyperbole, then let them.
Steve Gadlin's rainbow dirt is the greatest invention I've heard on the
Thank
radio
you.
Since sweaty balls.
We should stop there.
There
I
you
think,
go.
Yeah, I think that's we end on a yay, and I think that tallies up as more yays than nays, right?
Yeah, there's. I'm just trying to get there's some really. I mean, it's amazing how colorful the language is.
Well, it's rainbow dirt.
Yeah, so I guess at the end of the day, I'm not sure this is a yay. This is a good one. 773 says, take the needle out of your arm.
Got it.
You're crazy.
I don't have a needle in my arm. I did actually just get my tetanus shot.
Okay.
I went and got a physical and got my tetanus shot.
773 says, I'd rather buy the Joe Dirt Special Edition Blu-ray. That's pretty good.
Now, that is an insult. I will take that as an insult, sir.
And then the final one is 630, which is really similar to a lot of them, which is why the F would somebody want that?
Okay.
So
But you know what? There is good ones here. There are people I missed a lot of these at the get off your high horse.
A lot of the good ones had swears in them, so you had to skip over them, I understand.
217, get off your high horse. Okay. I tried to be objective with your quote-unquote invention. Yeah. You lost me with your put-downs of the master gardener.
Well, you had said the last
you're
one.
You're a loser. Get out of here. So. Your ego's too big. Okay. Loser.
Okay. Again, so. That's their opinion.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And then the last one, 773, Steve is a genius.
Thank
so,
you. I think that's that to me is the most telling.
All right, we're out of time for this week's frying pan. Rainbow dirt. You like it, Martyr? Yeah.
You know, one observation quickly is that I always viewed gardening as kind of a passive, peaceful endeavor. Mm-hmm. You've really fired these people up. I don't want to be near you when you walk into the parking lot tonight.
Yeah.
Well, the gardeners can get angry.
No, they can. And I think that's because they're overworked. And with something like rainbow dirt, they might get to take a chill pill and just spread it and forget it, you know?
Well, that's a good tagline.
It is. It is a good tagline.
Frying pan's over. Rainbow dirt, not that successful because you made no friends with the gardeners of the Illinois area.
The millennials
might like it.
They're very
Steve
excited.
Gadlin, we'll see you next Friday. Thanks for coming in, bud.
Take care.
All right, that's going to do it for the download tonight. We'll be back on Monday night. This is Chicago's very own 720, WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. In for Patty Vasquez tonight. This is exciting. How about it? Jones and Mike.
Yeah, baby.
How you guys doing?
Big shoes to fill.
Yeah, big shoes to fill.
I'm nervous.
We've done it before, though, but this is exciting to be back again. The first time they didn't let us in the showcase. Now we're in the showcase.
Yeah, I don't think that... You know what? And I feel the... Steve
yeah.
Gadlin.
Yeah, right.
There's like a negative vibe following Steve.
Right. We're going to have to burn some sage.
And he seems like a happy guy, exactly. And people are so mean to him.
He comes in with a lot of optimism, and he leaves dejected. It's hard sometimes to be in the room.
Yeah.
Right? I think, though, I blame you.
I try, man.
I think you just have to be that way. Like, you've seen him. You've seen him out there with Cuban trying to do the I want a cat for you thing. Like, you've got to be fearless.
You have
and he's
to
that.
Have thick skin, right?
He does. That's it. Hey,
so what are you guys going to talk about today?
Yeah, well, I cry. So if you're mean to me, man, I'm not going to take it like Gadlin did.
I'm not. I'm the objective one. But the people at home, man, they get mad. They get mad.
Well, we're gonna help people at home get sexy.
Good.
And we're also going to slather them with bacon.
Oh.
That's right.
Doesn't get better than that.
That's right. Apparently someone's going to be in here making bacon-infused drinks.
There you go, man. There you go. That sounds
good.
But
not before we talk about self-improvement and how to get sexy without hitting the gym.
Right.
So sexy without hitting the gym.
That's right.
It's about how you walk.
It's the rate. It's how you radiate.
You're right. Yes. Right. The inner Tony Manero in all of us.
Yes.
We're going to help you strut.
All right. I'll be listening. I like that. The how to get sexy without going to the gym. That's actually really good information.
Yes,
I'll
convenient,
yeah,
helpful,
exactly.
And convenient.
All the bacon drinks you can
And bacon drinks on top of
eat.
It. Yeah. Sounds like a great show, man. Have a great show, guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.